Okay, we're going to finish up with a couple of public comments, and then I'm going to bring it back to the council for decisions. Joe? I thought I saw... I've got Joe Orlando and then Jim Odlin.
Are we all set, Mr. Chairman? Again, my name is Joe Orlando. I'm a Gloucester fisherman. I got a 65-foot boat. And like I said earlier, you know, I've been coming to these meetings my whole life. I haven't been coming for the last couple of years. Because I think we've had good representation. The other day, you know, when I got my, after all these years of coming to these meetings, really educating myself coming to all these council meetings, and you people sitting in those seats, some of you guys are new now, but educated me, you know, through all these different rules that we made up. And I went out and bought two additional permits on top of my original permit. And after finding out that, actually we had too many days, somebody on the council said, well, you know, you can go buy a C-day permit. You can put it into with your original permit. Now you can lease more extra days into it. And that's what I did. So from my original permit, I went out and bought three additional permits. And it was done through you people. Like I said, some of you are new now. What I'm trying to say is that I'm here today because of what I've learned here. And now you people that are here today, you need to stick with us, guys like me and everybody else in the audience. Now you need to back me up because I did everything, and we all behind me did everything you people told us to do. No question. It's time to send a message to the agency, to the science center, and whoever else, even the environmental groups. This morning, my sector manager, David Levier, came up and gave you a presentation of the numbers that we caught for the last 2 years. Even though Gulf of Maine caught it down a little bit, so what? That's fishing. The last month, we can't get away from them. We had totals of 1 hour, 7,000, 8,000, 10,000. Where do they come from all of a sudden? But if you look at the numbers that he said, okay, we went up. We took a 22% cut on Gulf of Maine cod last year, so I went out and targeted flounders more than I did any other year. And you know what? We had no trouble catching these fish. I'm even up on my quotas. So what's that to say about the science? That's true science. Those numbers he gave this month, 2 years. Why ain't we seeing a 55% reduction on witch flounder? Why ain't we seeing 41% reduction on Cape Cod yellowtail? 54. Those are true numbers. That's not bullshit. That's actual true stuff that we report to the government, to the agency every day. How come we're not seeing it? So under those scenarios, you need to stick with us. Send a message to the agency. We're not doing nothing. This is bullshit. I'm done, like I told you this morning. I got a 65-foot boat. Either I got to get rid of the boat and fire myself and give everything to my son. That's the only way we're going to make it. Now he's got to go buy a 40-foot boat. But try to make that investment. It ain't going to happen because the money in there. I got my PC, whatever you call them. I got no card, first of all, because it's blank. Everything else is reduced by 40 and 50, 60%. It's over. I heard Mr. Kopp talked this morning twice. It seems to me I don't understand things very well. I can speak pretty good, but I don't know if he was looking for a way out or something. He put so many things out there to me that,
Joe,
you know.
Joe, direct your comments to me, please.
I do, Mr. Chairman. I'm sorry for that, but he's talking about water temperature, changes in the environment. What's he trying to tell us? And John, you came to Gloucester, and I seen you twice in the same day, in your office when you invited us up, National Marine Fisheries Service, and the City Hall. And you told us, that you're going to do the right thing. And I'm going to hold you to that. I want to see if you're going to do the right thing or not. The right thing to do is just have a status quo until, to the chair, Mr. Cobb, from all what he said today twice, gets sorted out. Because I saw so many different things that he was trying to say, and I really don't understand what to make of it. But like I said earlier, you people better step up and back us up for once. Because I really can't believe that you're going to do this. You better not. You know, because I've lost all faith. Guys like me are gone. Is that what you want to see? Gloucester's gone. You know? You need to make up your mind today. If you really think everything's happening is true, then do what you got to do. But if you got any doubts, send a message. You know, I'm going to lose my house. You people better, I hate to say it, but you're part of me. You should lose your house too. You know, because I did everything you told me to. Everything. It can't just be blamed on us. It can't. You're going to have some kind of accountability on your part. You know? I thought we were going to celebrate a year ago. I don't know what the hell happened. So, like I said, John, this is the time. You say you're going to do the right thing. I want to see it. Thank you.
Jim Odlin.
Jim Odlin, Portland, Maine. Believe me, I'm relieved that I'm not sitting up there today, because I don't think that there's a good decision or the right decision can be made by you guys in reference to the specs here. Several months ago, I happened to be in a meeting when the Deputy Administrator of NIMS, Sam Roush, came and told us that things looked very grim and that we will potentially facing these kind of cuts. A lot of people here were there. And at that time, we spent about half a day talking about, okay, this is what's up in front of us. We're going to have to operate differently. We're going to have to do things outside the box in different ways. We don't know those ways, but we're going to have to do it differently. And to a couple of things, to minimize any possible way we can the effects that we're facing. He also brought that same message to the full council on a webinar, I think it was in June, I'm not sure exactly the date, and said the same thing. I look at what's going on here right now is that we're doing things exactly the same way we've always done them. You know, we're following the same blueprint on how we're dealing with specs, emotion, a framework, and we're operating in the same realm that we've always operated in when we can't. I don't think this is a good motion. I think you need to be thinking differently. I would be suggesting that you'd split off the specs from this framework right now, and deal with everything else that are in the specs that you can do to mitigate and the other issues that are in this framework. And then you come up with some kind of spec process or request for an interim rule, and maybe you base it on a 20% reduction from the 2011 catch and on most of these stocks, and then you move that forward for a year as an interim rule. Maybe you can do it in the specs pack, a late specs package. I'm not sure. That's where the outside-the-box thinking has to come in. But I know one thing. That probably won't pass or won't get through anyway. That's just, I mean, I don't know how you could even function with a projected type of catch. I don't think it probably goes far enough on a couple of stocks. So my suggestion, again, is a 20% cut from the 2011 catch. That is moving you towards ending overfishing for sure in Gulf of Maine cod. You're utilizing the second year of your interim action. It's an under emergency action now, but I think you can do another, the second year of your move towards ending overfishing. I think that if you make a decision today, it can't be right. It can't be right for the stocks, and it won't be right for the industry for sure. So I would postpone the decision on the specs and repackage things and come back to that maybe in January. I'm sorry. Thank you. Yes, that would be a good one.
John Bowen.
Mr. Chair, is this the end of public comment?
Yes, my intention is now to bring it back to the council for motions and discussion.
I would just like to make some general comments before there's a motion, because there has been a lot of public comment from the heart. And I'd like to respond to each and every one, but of course I can't. Joe Orlando said, you know, it's important to do the right thing, and I couldn't agree more. Of course, it's hard to tell what is the right thing to do, Joe. It's agonizingly hard to figure out what is the right thing to do, but it is what I spend all the time thinking about, how to do the right thing. Frank Morarchy said National Standard 8 is an important standard, just as important as National Standard 1 and 2 and all 10 of them, that we think about the fishing communities. As I've said, my definition of fisheries is fish and fishermen. And we have the stocks of fish and the stocks of fishermen both at such low levels that how we make decisions to protect both are now so extraordinarily difficult because the stocks of fish and the stocks of fishermen are both so low that these decisions become very difficult. I don't know when I attended my first meeting of a fishery management council. I think it was probably 20 years ago or more, and probably in the King's Grant or someplace. But some of you were there. But it's a generation of dealing and hearing many of the same arguments. And you, those of you who were there, ask ourselves, have we made progress? We're arguing and criticizing the science, and we're seeing stocks that are so important to our communities continue to bounce along on the bottom of historic lows. We don't make progress doing things the way we've been doing them. It was Jimmy's dad, you know. We're doing this for generations and not making progress. And so we owe ourselves a better job, a better way of doing this. We have to rebuild stocks. We can't just keep doing this, bouncing along the bottom, continuing to trade tomorrow for today. We have to do it in a way that doesn't sacrifice, but that builds a better tomorrow. We have to find a way to do it. We have to do the right thing, but we have to get out of this and rebuild fisheries. How do we do it? The science, especially on yellowtail, I share the frustration that I'm sure is shared by everyone in the room, including first and foremost Dr. Karp, about the uncertainty of the science of yellowtail. I wish that we could all look at that science and say it is crystal clear. It isn't. I'm not a scientist. I went, as Dr. Pierce and others, to the August meeting and heard the science dissected with a scalpel by, you know, Steve Cadran and others about the imperfections of that science. But I also heard Dr. Cadran, Dr. Sissonwine, and others say, despite all the imperfections, there is agreement that the stocks of yellowtail flounder are in trouble. There's consensus about this. That's why it needs to be a bycatch fishery. That was the fundamental finding of that. And so, and they also said, you know, they were asked repeatedly, do you reject the advice of the track? And they repeatedly said, no, we don't reject the advice of the track. So we have it. It's frustrating that there are retrospective patterns. It's frustrating that there's uncertainty, but that's what we have to go on. There are hard truths we have to face. Maggie Raymond mentioned the issue of climate change. And again, I'm not a scientist, but I'm very troubled by how the impact of climate change is going to make, is already making, our jobs much more difficult. And again, the fishermen, excellent observers, you all are out there all the time observing. You see this. You certainly see temperature changes. You see movement of fish better than I do. This is causing changes, probably going to create some winning situations, some losing situations. You may, but those aren't the only changes going on. There are going to be changes in chemistry, in acidification, that are going to have changes as well, harder to see. I don't know how that's going to create any winning situations. I can see how it's going to create losing situations. And it's going to make our jobs a lot harder. And at some point, these changes are going to find their ways into fishery management plans. And just as we have to subtract things from overfishing limits to deal with management uncertainty and scientific uncertainty, we are going to, at some point, have to be subtracting things to deal with climate change. That'll be in our future, and that'll make things harder. That's the truth we're going to have to deal with. That's not a pleasant truth, but we're going to have to face that too. Can we rebuild fisheries without hurting people? No, we can't. That's the hard truth. I wish the answer was we can do our jobs rebuilding fisheries and not hurt anyone. I wish we could do that. We can't do that. We can't do that. Can we make decisions that don't hurt people? Yeah, we can make decisions that don't hurt people today. We've been doing that. I think that's why we're where we are. We're good at doing that. I really don't think over time that gets us where we need to be. And I think, you know, I wish it were different. I really wish it were different. Joe, doing the right thing is a hard thing to figure out, Joe. It's a really hard thing to figure out because today is really important. It's really important, but so is tomorrow. Thanks.
Terry Stockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 4.1.5, move to adopt a constant harvest strategy that reduces Gulf of Maine cod, Gulf of Maine haddock, Georges Bank cod, American Place, Witch flounder, Cape Cod, Gulf of Maine, Yellowtown flounder, ACLs by 10% from projected 2012 catches. I'll pass the committee 6-4-1.
Committee motion does not require a second. I am going to make a few comments on this. I've been thinking about it since I attended the meeting yesterday. There was some discussion about this motion. We got some feedback from the service on this motion. It is clearly, it does not meet the requirements of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. I think if the council were to pass this motion, it would also be a disservice to the people who are here in the audience today, because a lot of people would think that we have, in fact, crafted a solution that was going to help them out. That's not the case. This will clearly not pass muster at the regional office. And the concept that we as a body should merely take this action and put the onus on the regional office to make the decision, so that essentially the regional office becomes the bad guy, that means that we give up our responsibility as a body who are supposed to be making these decisions. And as John Bullard said, these aren't easy decisions. And I happen to think that once you begin to do that, you begin to make this council totally irrelevant. You begin to give all of the authority to the regional office to make the kinds of decisions that we're here to make. With that in mind, I'm going to rule this motion out of order. Terry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also have had a chance to reflect on yesterday's committee meeting, and I've got a motion, John. I move to split section 4.1.5 from framework 48 and to initiate an ACL spec package for final action at the January council meeting.
Dave Preble, second. Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Provide a little bit of rationale. Apart from the legal issues that you raised, this will allow for this council to approve the many other measures in Framework 48 today. It will allow for the Groundfish Committee to meet after the SSA meeting in January to incorporate the updated COD ABCs. It will allow for the Groundfish Committee to work with industry to think through some of the other measures that have been we've heard from the advisors and from industry over the last couple of days. And it will allow for the PDT to provide some additional analysis on a number of the issues we've heard from the public today.
Council discussion. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Terry, I'm assuming that the intent of the motion is at least in part to provide further opportunity for discussion about what to do with some of the more notable problems that we have in terms of stock abundance as judged by the current assessment and the one that's about to be completed, and that is Gulf of Maine cod and Gulf of Maine haddock. Gulf of Maine cod potentially is going to be drop from around, 6,200 or 6,700 down to about 2,000, potentially, depending upon the outcome of the ongoing assessment.
Gulf of Maine haddock is going to be dropped from about 779 to 187 metric tons. So that's pretty much the death knell for the Gulf of Maine groundfish fishery. So I'm assuming that your intent is to provide some additional opportunity for discussion with the National Marine Fisheries Service about the merits of the possibility of using of our requesting some interim action, interim measures to reduce overfishing, not end it, but reduce overfishing, similar to what we did with Gulf of Maine carp in 2012. So it will be a repeat for 2013 and a brand new thing, a brand new initiative for Gulf of Maine haddock. So that would give the service an opportunity to think about that. Is that a way in which we could go pursuant to MSA Section 304E6? We've been there. We've used it. It worked rather well. It led to some good discussions with the service, bringing in industry involvement as well, more interaction with the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. So if that's the intent of this motion, or at least a major part of the reason behind your motion, then it sounds like a reasonable way to go. I'm not exactly sure how to react to it because it did come out of the blue. But it's far, since the committee's motion was ruled out of order, and I understand why the chair did that. I don't necessarily agree, but I understand why he did that. This would seem to be the best opportunity, because the best course of action for us to pursue, because if we today go with the other option before us, then we have lost the Gulf of Maine groundfish fishery, and we likely will lose the Georges Bank groundfish fishery, and that means the outcome is obvious. Shifts to other fisheries, tremendous economic dislocations, more and more consolidation. The outcome is just nightmarish, and I'm very sensitive to the comments that have been made by those who have come to the microphone already. And I'm very sensitive, of course, and understand the perspective offered up by John Bullitt. I'm torn with this as well. What's the right decision to make? So I'll think some more about this, but as it stands right now, although some people may think we're putting off a tough decision until later on, that's not my attitude. This does have merit, and I think I'll be supporting it. I'm not positive yet, but I think I'll be supporting it.
Terry Starkwell.
Yeah, thank you, David. As you know, the Groundfish Committee spent better part of 2 hours on this one measure alone yesterday, only to have our motion ruled out of order. I think we can do a better job with a little bit more time, with far less impact on the industry. Every bit of rationale that you provided is my exact intent.
Terry Alexander.
Yeah, I get a question for John. Would that in turn, if we voted for this, would that in turn give you time to go to the Canadians with to work on the yellowtail issue that we have up there with the, you know, where we have an 1150 number? I know it's not actually in the package yet, but that's what we're working off. That's what I'm working off anyway, as a council member. Would that give you time to go to them and maybe talk to them about that?
It's several issues. If you were to look at the number 1150 on Yellowtail, one is the Canadian issue. So I'll answer that one first. At the meeting in Newport in November, several people said, well, we don't need the agreement with the Canadians. And I would remind us all that there are several advantages of the resource sharing agreement with Canada. One is that without that agreement, the first thing we would have to do is to assume the cod catch that the Canadians would make before we set our own catch for cod. And so that might result in there being zero cod available for us. The second thing that the resource sharing agreement does is allow us relief from the mandatory 10-year rebuilding period. Those are two advantages of the resource sharing agreement. Of course, there's shared science and other things, but just the ability to negotiate the shared COD allocation as opposed to taking the assumed Canadian catch off the top, which might result in zero COD for us, is a reason to have the agreement with Canada. So I think the Canadian agreement is very much something to pay attention to. It was negotiated a long time ago, not by me. We just live under it. In talking after all the headlines appeared, saying whatever they said to my Canadian counterpart, what would happen if we had something other than the number agreed to, she said, well, you know, you could bring that number back to us, and you have done that before, and we could start over again in the negotiations. So, you know, that's what we'd do, Terry. We would bring that number back and see what would happen. It would be a negotiation, so you can't figure out what would happen. You can't anticipate it. That is one part of that 1150 number. The other more important parts are whether that number stands up to the Magnuson Act, whether it is consistent with National Standard 1, does it violate overfishing, and is it consistent with National Standard 2, is it best available science? And, you know, I've expressed before, I don't think I'm allowed to speak personally, actually. Am I allowed to speak personally? Not anymore, John. You know, so I've got doubts whether it meets either of those standards. Thanks.
Anyone else in the council? Doug.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons for having this special meeting was to be able to have the specifications package in place in time for it to be implemented by May 1. And I'd like to ask the service if we do delay the decisions on the specifications package to the end of January, will it still be able to get in by May 1st?
John.
I'm going to give a quick answer, and then I'm going to turn to the person who really knows the answer here, George. It makes it very difficult, and there'll probably be the need for an interim measure, but this is important to get this right, Doug. So we understand the reason for this delay, and if this is the will of the council, we'll find a way to make it work. So we want to get this right. I'm not going to say it's a hardship, because what you've heard here is hardship. All right, we'll make this work if this is the way to do it. But George, you want to amplify on this?
Yeah, that's generally right. I think going through normal process with the council taking final action on that date would be very difficult for us to get measures in place by May 1, and that would be very problematic because the ACLs we would have no ACLs, and that's not acceptable. So I think we probably would look at something like an interim rule that we could do as quickly as possible, get something in place. It would probably, you know, be as close to what we could make it to what the council has voted up at that meeting. And then that would probably be superseded with the normal package coming from the council when we get that. So I think if we can make it work, we'll have to patch it together.
I appreciate that, hearing that you'd be working with us on this. So that makes me a lot more comfortable with voting for this, splitting this out. Thank you.
John Quinn.
Thank you very much, and I'm in support of this amendment. I first want to start by saying that I've dealt with John Bullitt for over 25 years in different capacities, and he certainly at the end of the day, has done the right thing for 25 years, regardless of who it's impacted and everything. So I just hope that that's understood here. As I listened from the testimony, particularly from the people with the scientific backgrounds, I heard these phrases, particularly regarding the SEC report and meeting that I attended. High level of uncertainty, retrospective patterns and biased, wide variability of conclusions, fairly limited confidence, wide range of estimates. Can't read my writing on this one. Wide range of how confident you can be in the outcomes. I think that if we get one more day, not even a month and a half, one more day to look at some of this data, I think we're going to be in much better shape than today. Some people may call it punting. Some people may call it avoiding a tough decision. I call it making sure we have every last piece of data and every last opportunity to make this decision that's going to potentially have some cataclysmic impacts on families and regions. So I fully support this amendment, and every additional day we can analyze this. And I appreciate Mr. Darcy saying it's going to be tough, we can work with it, but I think we really have to do this today. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Gene.
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to the question that Dave Pierce asked Terry about how the possible exceptions to ending overfishing with regard to Gulf of Maine cod, Gulf of Maine haddock might play into this. And just to put this into full context, those are extremely rare exceptions. We did it for Gulf of Maine cod last year. Those kinds of measures have to be requested by the council of the agency. It's not an option for the council to put into the specs themselves. It's something that is only delegated to the agency, to Department of Commerce, to do. So that must be kept in mind. The other thing is, we were pretty firm in our letter with respect to Gulf of Maine cod that this was going to be a one-year exception only, that we could not do it back-to-back. So, you know, we certainly have to consider any request to for additional exception, but you know, I don't want to put out a false hope there, given the fairly definitive nature of that letter back in May. With respect to Gulf of Maine haddock, that is not a similar situation to Gulf of Maine cod, despite what has been said, because this was not a plan that's under rebuilding. It was not one found to not meet the rebuilding plan. It was only specified that it was approaching an overfished condition. And so while technically that may be subject to the exception, you know, it's considered in a different light than the Gulf of Maine cod. It is not at all an identical situation, and the agency would have to deal with the logic of as a stock approaches an overfished condition, do we back off the measures to ensure that it gets to that point? So those are some of the complications that we're dealing with those two issues. I think it's important to be transparent and upfront about that. I'm not predicting any specific outcome one way or the other, but I do want to, you know, put out the sort of the practical facts and considerations that the agency is going to have to consider for those two things.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Gaethel.
I'm opposed to the motion, completely and totally opposed to it. These men came here today, men and women, they came here today to have a debate, to discuss their future. The chair said in ruling the action out of order that the council would be irrelevant if he didn't rule the action out of order. My feeling is that by ruling it out of order, you've already made us irrelevant. If we don't have the ability to manage the fishery, then we may as well be disbanded. People came here today to debate their fate in a democratic fashion. A lot of these men are day boat fishermen. This was the only day of the week that the wind hasn't blown 40. It's the only day, and they took that day to come here and discuss with you their fate. A lot of people have to go home tonight and make decisions about things like, do I cancel my health insurance effective immediately because I can no longer pay for it? Those are the kinds of decisions that these men are making right now based on the information that has been provided to them. Yesterday, the Groundfish Committee offered you a viable way out, a new way of doing business, exactly what Sam Rush told us to do. Find a way out of the box. We found a way out of the box. We would have conserved fish and kept some people fishing. Not everybody. We can't save everybody. I understand that better than anybody in this room. But we could save some people. The longer you wait, the less people you're going to save. And I think it's disgraceful. I think it's absolutely, totally, 100% disgraceful. And I don't think waiting a month is going to change anything if we're going to just do things the same way we've always been doing them. Like one guy said in the audience here today, it's like Einstein. You know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. So I can't believe we're hearing what we're hearing here after lunch. Honest to God, I can't. It's just incomprehensible to me. These men are citizens of the United States. They deserve a lot better than how they're being treated. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Peter Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little torn. I absolutely agree with Dave. But I also agree with John that if we can get any more information that would help, I think we should do it. But I, like Dave just said, I don't think anything's going to change in a month from now. I mean, you just heard Gene say that the interim measures that we could be looking at in another month probably won't go through. So we're going to have the same fight in another month from now. And I don't think, I just don't think anything is going to come of it. Any different outcome is going to come in another month. And everybody seems to be talking about George's yellowtail and Gulf of Maine cod and Gulf of Maine haddock. Well, we also got Cape Cod yellowtail. We got witch flounder and plaice. They're going to be cut, you know, 50 to 70%. And we might not have an interim rule on those. We might not be able to. So I don't, you know, like Dave said, it's a disservice to the people sitting here. You know, you're going to ask them to come back in another month from now and fight the same fight. And they might not be here in another month from now. Thank you.
Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm absolutely sensitive to Peter and Dave's concerns. And to answer Peter's question from my standpoint, what we'll have in a month, at least for the cod stocks, are assessments and an SSC review of those assessments that we don't have now. I opposed the motion from yesterday in no small part because we're setting harvest levels on two key stocks without even giving the SSC the opportunity to review the assessments. I mean, from my standpoint, that just can't happen. And I have some real concerns, assessments aside, about the Georges Bank cod stock. I think a lot of people do. So, you know, to answer the question, where are we going to be in a month? I'm not happy kicking this down the road, but I couldn't vote for any cod stock number absent an SSC discussion of the assessments. So we'll have that the next time we meet up. And I am, again, sensitive to the concerns, and we've heard a lot, and a lot of people have expressed their views, and I think that's been really helpful. But we can't set COD ACLs without that crucial step. And the next time we meet at the January Council meeting, that will have been done, and I think it needs to be done first. So I will be supporting this motion.
Anyone else on the council? Matt McKenzie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to support this motion as well. There's just too much on the line for us to rush to a decision, especially when we know there's more information imminent. People took time off today. I understand that, and that's a sacrifice. I want this to be the worst possible sacrifice. I know that's wishful thinking, but I want this to be one of the worst sacrifices they have to face. If we rush this decision today, no, I'm not willing to accept those consequences, not when we can wait for better information a short amount of time. I'll be supporting this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion on the council? I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion? Fifteen. Opposed? Two opposed. Abstention? Recusal? Motion carries 15-2. Terry.
Section 4.2.1, to recommend that the council adopt section 4.2.1.2, option 2, revised accountability measures for the recreational fishery. Pass the committee 10-01.
Committee motion, no second required. Discussion. Tom.
I recognize that we're going to revisit the specifications in January, but there was another motion with respect to Southern New England winter flounder, and I don't know if you want us to deal with that or just deal with that in January.
Tom, I deliberately didn't bring it. It's part of 4.1.5, and I'm sure the committee will incorporate it into the recommendations we make at the upcoming spec package.
Tom.
The reason I'm asking is because were that motion to pass, we would need to ask the SSC for a different ABC for that stock based on a new mortality target. And the SSC meeting is probably going to be before the Groundfish Committee meeting meets.
Terry.
Thank you, Tom, for the cuff on the side of the head.
Let's dispense with this one, then come right back.
Yeah, can we vote this one up first, and then we'll come back to 4.1.5.
To the motion on the board. Call the question. All those in favor? Sixteen in favor. Opposed? Abstention? Motion carries. Terry.
Section 4.1.5, move that consistent with guidance provided by NIMS in its May 30, 2012 letter to the council, the committee recommends that the council replace current measures for Southern New England winter flounder with similar interim measures that include, one, setting an ACL below the OFL of 2,637 metric ton, but no less than 1,400 metric ton. That will prevent overfishing and mitigate the impacts of the catch reductions for other stocks in fishing year 2013. Two, anticipating an ACL in excess of 1,400 metric ton will eliminate the prohibition on possession and change the status of Southern New England winter flounder to an allocated stock specified in Amendment 16. And three, request that the SSC provide a revised ABC estimate based on these terms of reference. Pass the committee 6-3-2.
Committee motion, no second. Discussion. Call the question. All those in favor? 16. Opposed? Abstention? 1. 16. Are you abstaining, Doctor? 16-01, the motion carries.
We're moving the next section.
Okay. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, before we leave the catch limit specifications, I thought it would be worthwhile to highlight a point made by Gene relative to a point that I made earlier on, and Terry Stockwell agreed with my logic, that is what would happen between now and in January, that is some consideration of, maybe at January, some consideration of interim measures for Gulf of Maine haddock and Gulf of Maine cod to reduce overfishing. Gene made a very good point. But clearly, if we wait until January to request, as Gene said we need to do, if we wait until January, then we've lost over a month of time. So I would move that the council request the National Marine Fisheries Service to implement interim measures for Gulf of Maine cod and Gulf of Maine haddock to reduce overfishing in fishing year 2013 pursuant to MSA section 304E6. And I make that motion with the recognition that we've already been operating for 1 year under interim measures with Gulf of Maine cod. If this motion passes, it'll provide an opportunity for the service to think about this and then tell us whether it's something that's viable or not viable. But it's definitely worth, I think, I believe, initiating this now as opposed to waiting until later on. So that's my motion.
Motion is seconded by Doug Grout. Discussion. Terry Alexander.
What does that do, Dave? I don't know what that does, so I want to know what it does before I vote yes or no on it.
Well, it means that we would potentially do what we did with Gulf of Maine cod in close collaboration, cooperation with the National Marine Fisheries Service to help us determine what the best course of action would be for 2013, Gulf of Maine cod and Gulf of Maine haddock, recognizing that it certainly with Gulf of Maine cod, that in light of what Tom Neese said earlier this morning, potentially we'll be shutting down the entire Gulf of Maine to ground fishing with a low ball number that we might actually get. So this would probably provide an opportunity for the service to deliberate, to think about this, and also provide them an opportunity to, and us as well, to get the Gulf of Maine cod stock assessment, see what that says, what that implies, and then we'll be in a far better position come January at our January meeting to know what can be done and what cannot be done.
Does that answer your question?
It does.
Further discussion. Tom Dempsey.
Just a question to the maker. From the explanation just now, it sounds like what you're really after is written guidance as to the potential application of interim measures for GOM cod and GOM haddock to be communicated back to the council prior to our making a decision there. But that, from my read of this motion, this is actually asking for the implementation of an interim measure. The former I can support. I think it makes sense to ask for a formal written guidance from NIMS and General Counsel as to whether interim action is even on the table for these stocks so that we have that information before we make the decisions in January. But to request interim action at this time, understanding that we just pulled the specifications portion of this document out, I don't really see as that it's time to do that. If you were open to a friendly amendment to insert the language, request the service provide written guidance as to the potential applicability of an interim rule with this, then I could support it.
Dr. Beard.
I wanted to be more forceful. I wanted to send the message that this is what I would hope the council would want the service to do. And then it would be up to them to tell us, okay, we can do it subject to your wishes, or no, we can't for these reasons that they would provide. So, again, it's something I'm hoping the council will do as a clear intent.
Just a comment. I see this as officially opening up the dialogue. And when we had the discussion before Gene gave his caution, as which lawyers usually do, I heard from the regional administrator a willingness to work with us on these issues. So I see this as opening up that dialogue and getting us to work with the service on this. You had something else, Tom?
Well, I can support opening up that dialogue. I think we must, but I'm uncomfortable. I remain uncomfortable with the wording of the motion because, as I read it, it's requesting an interim measure, not requesting some guidance on whether that's applicable. It's a formal request for an interim measure. That seems to be going somewhat farther than you described it. I'd like to hear other people's thoughts on it, but I don't think we're in a position right now yet to request an interim measure. I think what you're after and what Dr. Pierce talked about after making this motion was we're after some guidance and information. That I think I could support.
Further discussion? Laura Ramsden and then Doug Grout.
I would respectfully disagree, Tom, and just put out that we need an interim measure, and if this gets the ball rolling a month sooner, then let's do it. And I would also just respond to Gene's comments that while we might have said in a letter that COD was only 1 year and Haddock might be different than COD, I think I would urge the agency and the legal department to look for solutions that would allow us out of this. And certainly some of the comments earlier about National Standard 8, when you tie Haddock and COD together, though they are different stocks with different circumstances, we certainly have an economic crisis that rises to the level that these people need help. So I hope we don't stand on the fact that we said it was only 1 year when, in fact, the law is giving us a two-year time frame. So I'm going to support the motion. Thank you.
Doug Grout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I seconded this motion because I think this is a very important request that we have to make of the service for them to evaluate whether this is something that can be done. It is my interpretation in reading Magnuson that you do have 2 years to develop a rebuilding plan, and during that period of time, you don't have to end overfishing, but you must reduce the fishing mortality rate. So given the fact that both of these assessments were, quite frankly, a surprise to, I think, a lot of people, because in the case of COD, as we know, we had an assessment that said that we were going to be rebuilt by 2012 and certainly came up with a surprise that we weren't there, even going to come close to it. And also with Haddock, we had a species where we weren't overfishing we were not overfished, and now we're approaching an overfished status. And even though we, in our first year of setting ACLs, we set the ACLs for Gulf of Maine Haddock, and the actual harvest was about 75% of the ACL. That terminal year, the estimate said that we had to take approximately a 70% reduction to end overfishing. Clearly, there's some things that are outside of our control that are going on here, and I think the applicability of this portion of Magnuson couldn't be more appropriate for these two species. Thank you.
Dave Preble, and I'm going to call the question.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I was particularly pleased to hear John Bullard say that that we would make this work. That's the kind of words I've been wanting to hear ever since I first started on this council, and recognize that we have been dealing with an entrenched culture of failure, is the way I've always put it. And so it was very welcome to me to hear him say that we would make this work. As far as this particular motion is concerned, the offending word here is implement. I don't think we're asking them to implement the interim measure right now. What I heard the chairman say was that we would be working. What this is doing is to enable us to work with the agency to make it work. So I'm not comfortable with the word implement. I'd rather see initiate. I'd rather see the word initiate, and if I can offer that as a friendly.
Dr. Pearson? No. Okay. Last bite, then I'm calling the question.
Yeah. according to the service, they are going to have to implement, even because we're setting the spec package in January, they're going to have to implement that anyway. So I say, why not give them the chance to start it up sooner? We don't necessarily have to use it once it's there, but it'll give, at least get them thinking about it. So I'm going to vote for it.
Call the question. All those in favor? Sixteen. Opposed? Abstention. Okay. 16-1. The motion carries. Terry.
It's time for public comment on the next suite of measures.
The next group of motions or sections that we will be covering are the groundfish monitoring revisions in section 422, dockside monitoring requirements 423, commercial fishery minimum size restrictions 424, Georgia's Bank yellowtail flounder management measures in section 314, and sector management provisions allowed exemption requests that's section 314 and section 426, commercial fishery accountability measures, and lastly 4265, trawl gear stowage requirements. I'll take any public comments on those issues at this time. Frank Meraki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Frank Meraki from Scituate, Mass. I'd like to speak a little bit about, I'm not quite sure of the structure of this, so forgive me if I wander a little far afield, but retention policies and minimum sizes. And I'd like to bring to the Council's attention the fact that probably the second most onerous adversity that our sector and other sectors deal with after low ACLs is discards, calculated discards, which in the case of our sector are running at about 15% of our total ACE. In some cases, this is deserved where the discards have been measured, but in other cases, it's not. And there are two operative problems. Problem one is the disconnect between the minimum sizes of the fish that are currently in place and the selection properties of the net, any net, because there is no rationality to these minimum sizes. They were set long, long ago in an era of input controls, and they deal more with the maturity age of the fish than they do with the selection of the fish by a net. Second issue is the fact that there's an inherent conflict between the overhead cost of catch monitoring and the need to have a high monitoring level so that the extrapolations don't run amok, basically, and run much higher than reality. So I'm here to support a couple of objectives that I've gleaned out of what I haven't had a chance to really comprehensively read yet. One is the possibility of going to a full retention policy, whereby basically we're responsible for retention of all multi-species. And my reason for suggesting that this is a good alternative are twofold. One is that a lot of what we're discarding basically is valuable. There's a ready market for fish that are an inch or two below the legal minimum sizes now, and those fish are simply being wasted. Two is that there is a really good alternative to human at-sea monitors, and that is electronic monitoring. I've had a system aboard my boat now since day one of Amendment 16. It is performed virtually flawlessly. Its one big drawback is that it's very difficult, hence expensive, for an auditor to take and interpret the data and actually identify by species and length the fish that are being discarded in the video. and it requires almost as much overhead cost to have somebody do that off the boat as it does to have a monitor to come onto the boat and observe the fish in the first place. So there's a conflict that could be reconciled by simply saying you have to keep everything in the video record as basically sufficient to prove that you have done so. The second point is that if the council chooses not to take such a giant leap as to go to a full retention policy, there's merit in looking at minimum sizes that are clustered around a common selection point, minimum sizes that are smaller probably in most cases than the sizes in place now, because, again, the argument for validity of the value of those fish still prevails. Plus, there is still a benefit to electronic monitoring in that if you can get the sample of disguided fish small enough, you can actually run what's called an audit program where the captain keeps a log of what's being disguided, and then a random sampling of the video record indicates the validity or the accuracy, I should say, of that log versus the observations of the reviewer of the video. So in either case, there's multiple savings. There's a potential savings in the overhead cost of at sea monitoring, and there's a reduction in the amount of waste and misallocated ACE that goes into calculating discards. So for those two reasons, I support these measures. Thank you.
Gibb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. Gibb Brogan with Oceana. We have some comments on most of the topics under this laundry list. We'd prefer to be giving them on each of the motions, but we understand the new council process. First off, on monitoring, Oceana's been following monitoring for quite a long while, and with the sector program, we're particularly interested. The sector program, as we see it, the accountability measures are integrally dependent on an effective monitoring program. Without reliable monitoring, the AMs for this fishery are in question. And we have real concerns about some of the adjustments that are being proposed in Framework 48 and how those will undermine the sector program. First off, on the goals and objectives, those were generally good, except yesterday at the Ground Fish Committee, the agency put in wiggle room, as they put it. They inserted language into one of the goals and objectives for the sector monitoring program that will provide flexibility, and as the agency person put it, necessary flexibility to let the agency do its job, and put in language that said that to the extent possible that monitoring will be effective for the ground fish fishery. That's not acceptable. This is part of the AMs for this fishery. AMs are not subject to, in Magnuson, they are required. There's no to the extent practical language in Magnuson. AMs are necessary and required, and there's no wiggle room there. And since AMs require monitoring, we don't see any wiggle room or any flexibility for the agency other than to have accurate and precise monitoring. So we hope that'll be adjusted as this moves forward. As far as the removal of the industry funding alternative, we understand that when this was introduced at the committee that this was a cry for help, and we understand that the industry is in no position to pay for its monitoring at this time. And in the past, the council has written letters to the agency, to Congress, asking for help. And that's entirely appropriate, and we suggest that that's the way that the council should move forward on this. The motion that you're going to have in front of you right now, the alternative is to set the level of monitoring for the ground fish fishery at the level that is provided by the agency. The regional administrator and NOAA General Counsel were very clear in November that that's not the way that this fishery should go. Monitoring for this fishery needs to be based on what the fishery needs, what it needs to administer the accountability measures. So alternative that's in there that will set the level of industry funding at what NIBS can provide, that's just an unworkable option, and we see that as undermining the sector program and the AMs, so we hope that will be removed. Let's see, as far as full retention, we're generally supportive of full retention. Minimizing or eliminating bycatch is a great goal, and we're fully supportive of that. the alternative that's in the document right now doesn't seem to be fully developed. It doesn't look at things like enforcement, compliance, monitoring, things that go along with that, looking at the other examples of full retention fisheries and how they've been effective. And we think that this is an idea that should be pushed forward to the next management action as something that can be developed for the sector fishery. But right now, in the absence of clear details on how that's going to be implemented, the nuts and bolts and the logistics of how a full retention fishery would operate, we don't support moving that one forward at this time. And let's see, down the list, flipping the page, closed areas. We believe that this should move forward in the omnibus habitat amendment. The analysis that has come out of the CAT at this point, it's a shame that Andy Applegate's presentation to the committee yesterday wasn't presented to the full committee today. There's very interesting information in there about what the CAT has found, what they expect to be caught in those areas, and some of the conclusions about potential access of the sectors in those areas. Our view on this is that the evidence that's in there in the CAT analysis is that there is a tremendous amount of risk to go into those closed areas and minimal, if any, benefits to the industry. And that considering the seasonality of the access, as I believe as Dr. Pierce pointed out, the seasonality of the access will take away many of those benefits. So we believe that it's not consistent with the goals of the FMP and puts the depleted stocks, things like Georges Bank Yellowtail, at risk of continued overfishing. So we urge the council to reject that alternative as well. So we look forward to the discussion, and thanks very much.
Judge Crawford.
Judd Crawford, Pew Environment Group. I just want to briefly comment on the proposal to allow exemption into the year-round groundfish areas. I understand the crisis. I think this is the wrong response to the crisis. I don't think it's going to help the people who most need help in the way people may think it's going to help. I think it's biologically going to probably have implications that we haven't fully thought through. There hasn't been enough analysis. The analysis that we have doesn't support fishing in these areas. The economic analysis that I've heard about so far doesn't really support the idea that this is going to be the great saving move that I think many people hope it might be. So I urge you not to do this. I think this should be something that continues to be developed in the context of the Omnibus Amendment. It needs a full, thorough, and careful analysis so that we really know what we're doing and end up with better habitat protection, not less habitat protection in New England if we ever want to get ourselves out of the hole that we seem to have gotten ourselves into. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Erica Fuller from Earth Justice. I'm speaking on Section 3.1.4. In the face of what's happening to the ecosystem and this fishery, it does not make sense to open access to the groundfish closed areas. Legally, this is not a frameworkable action. It's not a mere adjustment to the FMP. It's a fundamental policy decision. If it's done, it needs to be done through an environmental impact statement. It would be hard to make a finding of no significant impact when you're opening access to 13,000 square kilometers of 22,000 square kilometers that have been closed and haven't been trawled in 15 to 20 years. The analysis you do have from the CAT is clear that the short-term economic benefits could have long-term biological effects on productivity. We ask that you do a comprehensive analysis in the Omnibus Habitat Amendment and that you do not make arbitrary and capricious decisions not based on the best available science. Thank you.
Jim Odlin.
Well, I'd like to start out by saying in the same two meetings I mentioned earlier, we talked about how could we, no matter which direction happens in the specs, we're going to have some significant cuts, major cuts. So in the previous two meetings, we talked about how are we going to mitigate as much as possible. You know, we have to do that. We have to mitigate and give the industry every opportunity it can to try to survive. The best way to for an industry to survive in aggregate, the infrastructure and everything else, is get pounds of fish over the dock. We have a potential huge year class of haddock coming at us. We had one in 2003 that we harvested approximately at a potential of 18% of that stock we harvested. Our Canadian counterparts who we share the stock with through that same period harvested approximately 94%. Had our industry harvested at that rate, we would have landed an additional, and these are my numbers, back of the envelope, $450 million worth of product that was lost yield. I would say if we'd have done that, we wouldn't be looking at a disaster. So my point is that we need to take a different approach, and we need to figure out ways to aggressively target the healthiest stocks we have. If we do that, it's my experience in over watching this and trying to make this work, that we will have an impact on the less healthy stocks in a positive way. So in order to do that, we need to get access to those fish. We don't have access to that stock of haddock on a consistent basis. We get it when it decides to swim out. And we can't keep our markets going. We can't keep the infrastructure going that way. So all we want to do is get access to the healthiest stocks of fish we have. These areas were closed. I remember when they were closed. I fished in those areas before they were closed. In fact, I've fished in those areas since they've been closed because I did some experiments for National Meat Fisheries Service. To somebody to say that they haven't been towed is just wrong. First of all, closed area one is towed almost every day by scallopers. It's an open area. Closed area two is towed by scallopers part of the time. The areas that, in none of these areas that are proposed to be open are current habitat areas or proposed habitat areas. They have nothing to do with what we're doing in the omnibus. So this is just purely, in my opinion, about trying to get access to healthier stocks. I think you're going to have enough control. You've taken care of the spawning periods. You're going to have restricted gear. And we've dealt with any possible gear conflicts with the lobster industry. I think you have to do this to mitigate this. If this industry does not get some pounds over the dock, it is gone. Not just the fishermen. A lot of other people will be gone. So I guess I'm in favor of the motion that you guys have in front of me. I want to talk, done with the closures, I want to talk a little bit about the minimum fish sizes. The minimum fish sizes is a leftover artifact from when we had quotas and input controls. And it does nothing but dump dead fish at sea. In fact, I submit it screws up our assessments. That's maybe one of our problems. Can't get an accurate count. If everything's coming to the dock, you can get an accurate count of the makeup of the catch at the dock. It's cheaper to do it at the dock. Your port samplers do it at the dock. Dead fish don't do anybody any good, and you can't count them. So most other places that I've gone to catch is that I have been able to look for, Canada, Iceland, anywhere, they don't have minimum fish sizes. Everybody knows it's just crazy to dump dead fish. When we had the last year class of haddock, I happened to be on the council, and I tried and tried to get the size reduced. We had discard rates at 30%, 35% on haddock. When you have a big year class coming through, you're going to have that happen, and we're about to have it happen again. We're already seeing the discard rates go up. We're already seeing the Canadians harvest this same fish. They're already cutting the fillets and shipping it down here. So if we go to full retention rule, you know, I've heard people say, well, that's crazy. You can't monitor. You don't do it. It won't work. Well, it's no different than what we're doing now, only we're telling people to dump the dead fish. If we have a full retention, we're just telling them you have to bring them in. It's the same amount of dead fish. It's just there's a few dead fish
that are undersized. Some of them are worth money. Some are not. I'll grant you that. Some are not going to be worth anything. They'll go to bait. But it's not doing, it's at least helping somebody for bait. But I want to get the numbers right. I want to have assumed discard rates that I will tell you are not accurate. You know, these observers are doing the best they can. They cannot estimate it, what's going on. They just can't. It just doesn't work. And I again say that may be what's wrong with the assessments, some part of what's wrong. So if we have 30% observer coverage and we have a no discard rule, then at least you know that for those trips, you're going to know what the makeup of the catch was exactly, because it'll be checked at the dock by just your regular port samplers. You don't have to have another system. You have it happening. So you can measure that against what the rest of the fleet is reporting and figure out that, oh, well, it's a little bit different. But then you can extrapolate and come up with a reasonable number of what really is going on in the fishery. Till you do that, when I believe we'll never get this right. And I'll just close on one other item, in that dead fish don't spawn. Never have, never will. It's not going to happen. And so we just need to bring this in, get the right numbers, not have a gotcha rule on the books all the time that some, you know. The fact is, anybody that's boarded at any time can be arrested because of this, for no reason, because you cannot have 100% compliance on a minimum fish size. You just can't do it. It's impossible for any fisherman to measure every single fish exactly. And so we need to get rid of that kind of stuff, move on so the fishermen can concentrate on what they'll do. I'm sorry I'm taking so long, Mr. Chairman, but one other comment is that people are going to increase their catch of small fish. You know, we had testimony yesterday all day long about the high cost of leasing. Now, I'm not that complex, but somebody's got to explain to me, why would somebody lease fish at a high cost, right, and purposely go out and target juvenile fish that's not going to meet that cost? It's not going to happen. Once you go to a catch share system, people do just the opposite. They target the bigger fish when they can. They don't target juvenile fish. That's proven. I mean, there was many big studies in Iceland how the catch went to the older fish once they went to a catch share system, and it was a problem. And so that's that. I think you need to support the motion the way it's went through the committee yesterday. Thank you.
Jackie O'Dell.
Thank you, Jackie O'Dell, Northeast Seafood Coalition. First, in this provision, I just want to make this public statement. It's just obviously the industry cannot pay for any portion of the cost for at-sea monitoring. When this first was put into the Amendment 16, no one thought that they would be at a situation where they're at today, where they were looking at such drastic reductions. The consolidation that's occurring in this fishery is because of the cost to operate and the reductions of catch and guys not being able to recuperate those costs. We need to build, if there's going to be any future discussion of industry paying for monitoring, it needs to be built into growth into this fishery. It cannot be considered at this point or any point in the near future. So that's just one comment that I have. Second is for the minimum fish sizes. I think it's fair to say we haven't taken a vote of our membership on this specific provision, but I will say that everyone's in agreement that no action is just not a possibility. There's just such a waste going on with discarding, and it's not good for the fish, and it's not good for the fishermen, because it's being taken off of their allocation, and their allocations are dwindling every day. So I said yesterday at the Groundfish Committee meeting, when this discussion first started and this framework was first being developed, it was based on being the sector framework and how can we make sectors be better. And one provision that was Northeast Fishery Sector 2 that started this discussion was that over 20% of their catch of Cape Cod Gulf Maine Yellowtail was coming from a fish that was just under the minimum size, was just under 13 inches. So this is what started the discussion of reviewing the minimum fish sizes. And now where that option stands today, I think it's a viable option that a lot of fishermen would support. It's well over the 50% maturity. It's reflective of the mesh size we're using and the size fish that guys are catching, and we need to start creating these discards into landings. So, you know, it's definitely a viable option. Full retention, I think our membership is some of our members are torn on this, but I definitely think it's a plan for the long term, and we strongly encourage the council to consider that. What was said before by Jimmy Odlum, the assumed discard rates, that's definitely not working, and it's not working for the fishermen who have their allocation continuously taken away from them as well because of the assumed discard rates, which many people are upset about. So for that, no action is just not an alternative, and we think that the minimum fish size is definitely a step in the right direction, and we hope that the fishery eventually will move to full retention. The last one, I guess we're also taking comments on the allowing sectors access to the groundfish closed areas. Again, there are a lot of promises that are being made to the fishery that are being broken over time, and one of them was that once the fishery moved to a hard total allowable catch, that some of the effort controls would be removed. These mortality portions that are being reviewed for guys, sectors to get access to on a very limited basis, are small areas. They don't overlap existing habitat areas. They're not, areas that are under consideration under the habitat omnibus. So it's a small opportunity for guys to start getting access back. And now that we're fishing under hard total allowable catches, I think that that's definitely the right way to move. And this would definitely be an option in many areas to mitigate some of the impacts that we're looking at for the reductions for next year. Thank you.
Jim Kendall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim Kendall, New Bedford Seafood Consulting. I'd like to see if I could pose a question here and possibly receive an answer on this, but pretty much throughout the day there's been discussions going on about the uncertainty in the science, even to the point where the SSC has supposedly put forward a vote of no confidence or discussed a no confidence vote, and a lot of the information has been brought forward. Is that an official position even from any of the parts of the service, whether John's office or George or Bill? You've all pretty much mentioned or spoke of these uncertainties. Is this a hard position or a viable position that's been taken by any of the departments that I'm referencing?
I'm not sure, Jim, what you're asking. Who's taking a no-confidence vote?
I'm not saying so much a vote, but everyone has mentioned or spoken to the fact that there is a high uncertainty, no confidence in a lot of the scientific information, to the point where we've been discussing doing another survey, which seems to be impossible. It seems pretty apparent that there's not much certainty involved in any of that scientific information.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Jim, I think all of the estimates, the assessment estimates that come from the Science Center come with measures of uncertainty.
I'm sorry?
All of the advice that is provided with measures of uncertainty. The science is uncertain, and the level of uncertainty, of course, varies depending on the particular stock, the quality of the data, the various factors that we've talked about that affect uncertainty. So I think framing the advice in terms of risk or uncertainty is just, a standard practice. To get to the survey piece that you're talking about, that's one of the sources of data, and it's one of the sources of uncertainty. And one thing that I think is important to note is that when we have a multi-species survey, and a lot of you have talked about the the compromises that are made, if you will, in the design of the survey, because we're trying to survey multiple species. Some are flatfish, some are not. Some spend all their time on the bottom, some don't. The availability to the gear, the catchability varies. So a multi-species survey, by definition, it provides less certain information on the distribution and abundance of the stock.
Maybe I need to be more clear about what I'm trying to get at,
okay.
Bill. I'm sorry. Let's take a dividing line of, say, 50%. And if you're working with scientific evidence or information, we often speak of uncertainty, and we often speak of risk-averse and so forth and so on. My question is have we crossed that line to be more uncertain than we are about any of our certainties? Are we that far away from it is what I'm asking. And the reason I need to know this is that I'd like to know how you could put a council to a vote on something that seems to have such a high rate of uncertainty attached to it. I just don't think that it's – I can't say legal, but I'm just saying it does something distractively wrong with that approach that you're making a requirement or a regulation – based on such a high level of what appears to be uncertainty.
I think that the council has to take into account the level of uncertainty in making the decisions that they make. So in terms of the science, it's our job to provide the best estimates and to do the best that we can to capture the uncertainty. In the future, it's part of our job to reduce that uncertainty, but that's a different issue. For the here and now, it's our job to provide the estimate and to provide the uncertainty and risk level, and then that then becomes a policy issue, if I'm understanding your question correctly, with regards to how the council uses that to make its decisions.
Well, I could go further, but my main point on this is that Magnuson was built around the premise of protecting the fish at the same time as protecting the fishing industry and the communities. And there seems to be a top-heavy top level that seems to come before the fishermen. And even though there's that much uncertainty, you're still taking risks that are more harmful to the fishermen than they are to the fish. And like I say, I don't think it's an appropriate place to put a council to have to make a vote on. I think at some point in time, they need to be aware of how risky that vote would be. But I thank you for trying to get it through my skull. I don't know if anybody else feels the same way, but that's definitely my case on this. I just feel that there's so much uncertainty, you can't make a rational decision, and I just think it's unfair, not only to the fishermen, but to the council as well. The issue about closed areas. I'm not a strong proponent about opening up closed areas, particularly about some of the ways they've been described before. Some people seem to think that they'd be thrown wide open. Others think controlled access, so forth and so on. The controlled access I can understand. But the problem I have with it is you're going to open up these areas, allow fishermen to go in and take the fish quicker and easier. So in other words, they'll have 2 or 3 days to fish, and then their season will be over because they'll be able to take the fish that quickly. That's all I see that this gains. We've gotten arguments that we're throwing open habitat areas that have been closed for habitat, and actually they were closed for aggregations of spawning ground fish at various times. At times, scallopers could access it during the spawning season, and then it got too hard to control, so they basically closed it to everyone since 1994, I believe it was. So that access plan would have to be planned out with enough idea about what is going to occur in there, so that it doesn't come back and blame the fishermen once again for ruining habitat and area closures. No discards. It's a good idea in some cases, particularly with round fish. I'm not so sure I support it on flatfish. Flatfish have a much higher survivability rate, even though we don't allow for that. The one issue I do have about closed areas is I had proposed years ago that closed area 2 should be picked up and moved over to the west at 10 or 20 miles so the Canadians stop gaining the benefits of the spill out into their area before American fishing boats can get to them. Barbara Stevenson once called it the Kendall Highway. I still believe it's a viable option. If we can't open the areas, you move it so that it benefits our fishery and not the Canadian fishery. Thank you.
Dick Allen.
My name is Dick Allen, and I'm speaking as a former council member who first started to try to get rid of the minimum fish sizes about 20 years ago, and I'm happy to see that it's receiving serious consideration at this time. I submitted fairly extensive comments, written comments, and I won't repeat all the comments that other folks have made, but I did want to point out that we've talked a lot about mitigation, and one of the easiest mitigation things we could do, I think, would be to let people keep the fish that they've already caught. It costs money to catch those fish and then to throw them away again. Very few businesses could survive if they had to throw back a substantial portion of their day's production. And that cost, whether the fish survive or not, it's still costly to go out and catch them again. So if you've caught them once and you can take that into account in setting the TACs and things, that it certainly is a much more efficient way to run a fishery to have people catch the fish that they've spent the money to catch in the first place. So thank you.
Thank you. Don?
My name is Don Swanson. I'm from the Coastal Conservation Association of New Hampshire. And I'm very concerned about the Western Gulf of Maine closure area, if that is opened. I've been a recreational fisherman for over 50 years. I have fished Stellwagen Bank many, many years. This past year, since sectors and catch shares come in, this is the first year that I fished on the bank and we couldn't catch one single fish in all the areas that I historically fished through my life. I'm afraid that if you open up this one area, this Western Gulf of Maine, you're going to see the derby fishing like you've seen in this past year. I understand these guys that they're not going to go as far as they have to because of fuel costs and stuff like that. But if you open this up, they're going to hit that area, I think, just the way they hit the Stellwagen this past year. I understand the big boats are still coming in there now. They've been hitting it already. So I would hope that you people would, when it comes to the closed areas, you can really consider the Western Gulf of Maine closure and keep it closed. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir. And I'm going to take one more comment after that. I saw Maggie's hand first.
Good afternoon. It's better. Josh Wiersma, sector manager for New Hampshire Groundfish Sectors 11 and 12. I just wanted to speak to a couple points. One, in regards to dockside monitoring, this is actually something I've been waiting to talk about for a long time, since the first year of sector management. Can you hear me better here this way? Okay. Perfect. That's amazing. Thank you, guys. So the first year of sectors, you know, we faced 50% dockside monitoring. And, you know, to me, as a new sector manager, that was the most useless part of my job, I think, just to get right to the point, where, you know, we got information from these monitors almost on a daily basis, yet I wasn't able to use any of that information in my management purposes. And so over the course of the year, what I had was a box in the corner of my office that accumulated dockside monitoring reports, and I just put them in there. I couldn't do anything with them. I couldn't use them for my ACE accounting reports. I couldn't use them for my detail reports. They weren't. National Marine Fisheries Service wasn't looking at them. Actually, nobody was looking at them. So they just kept accumulating, and they filled up this big copy box in the corner of my office. And in addition to that, you know, I would be contacted on a daily basis from my dockside monitoring coordinator, who would tell me about all these issues. My boats, you know, were for whatever reason, you know, they might have done their trip start hail late or did it early, and, you know, all of these different transactions costs that would build up and build up over the course of the year. And so for our sector, those transactions costs were tremendous. And the utility that we got from the dockside monitoring program was less than zero, actually. It was more of a tremendous cost and a burden to our whole sector. And so, you know, due to very unfortunate circumstances, I believe it was David Gaethel's fall in New Hampshire that convinced everybody that, you know, this program was not only useless but also dangerous, to send these monitors who didn't have any training to go on vessels to, because I think at that time they were thinking about having them look in the fish holds to see what other fish was left over, because, you know, fishermen have a propensity to cheat. And so, you know, that, I think, created some cooler heads at the time, and you guys voted to eliminate the program. And so when I heard that it was coming back, it was just like, you know, it was almost like, you know, right, I guess that's, you know, the word that I'm looking for. And so moving forward with, you know, if you're going to have a rational fishery, I think first and foremost we need to eliminate any further discussion of dockside monitoring unless you allow the data to be used by sector managers for our reports. I think that will give us some utility for the sector standpoint. And just as speaking to the dealers' experiences with dockside monitoring, it's, you know, this is what is, along with the reductions in ACLs and tax, is what's concerning them the most, because it's a tremendous cost to their businesses, especially these smaller dealers that we deal with in New Hampshire. You know, on average, a dockside monitor creates an additional 15 minutes per offloading time. So over the course of the year, you know, we offload about 2,000 boats. You know, that time is additional cost that they pay their employees, that they have to pay their overhead, their cost of operations. They reroute where they send their trucks to go to these remote ports, and when they can actually coordinate, you know, their actual landings efforts with the dockside monitors. So for the dealer's standpoint, you know, that makes no sense. It's been useless to them. From our standpoint, it's a tremendous transaction cost that has no utility for us. And so I urge you to accept the option to eliminate the dockside monitoring program. And so then I guess we lead into the minimum fish size requirements. I think that, you know, everyone knows that we waste fish and discards. It's fish that, you know, comes off directly out of our fishermen's pockets. You know, I had a horrible discussion with David the other night, letting him know that the amount of discards in one of the flatfish that he has, you know, accounted for almost half of his initial allocation. And it was really as a result of just the way that things are calculated. And it's, you know, it's hard for me to see these guys losing so much money because of that. And so, you know, I would be in favor of some type of either reduction on minimum fish size, full retention. But I think it also needs to be considered, you know, how the dealers play into this. Right now, I think there's an assumption that you can just create in a market for a 2-inch dab that comes in and not have any understanding of whether that market is actually there. And so, you know, I think it's a discussion that's definitely worth having, but perhaps a little bit more needs to be thought about how you'd flush out those issues. And finally, I just wanted to speak to the closed area issue. And, you know, to me, I think it's important for me to remind you that the closed areas that you're proposing to be open are not habitat areas. These are mortality areas. And so, to me, there's no difference at all, except for increasing our catch per unit effort, which I think is a good thing, moving forward in sectors. You know, we're facing, as we have been for the last 3 years, a hard tack, so we can't catch any more fish than we've already caught. You know, we're not going to be impacting habitat, and so I am in favor of opening access to some of the year-round closers. And just to let you know, from our sector, that's all I can speak for, it's not a significant amount of boats that would actually potentially go in these areas. And we're talking between 4 to 6 vessels that might take an additional 15 trips in these areas. And a lot of them would go in to try to target monkfish, which is an area in Fifties and Cash's Ledge that it's been closed now for the last 15 or 20 years, but which has historically been a very productive monkfish fishery for these guys. And moving forward would be a very big benefit to them if they could subsidize their income from groundfish that way. That's it. Thank you very much.
Maggie, and then I'm going to do Patrick, and then we're going to, because you have.
Thank you. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. When I spoke about in support of the motion yesterday for full retention, I talked about the benefits that I think that full retention brings to the stock assessment process. And having sat through many, many stock assessments, one of the biggest sources of uncertainty is always, what is the actual catch? And I sat through some of the recent COD assessments, both of them, and listened to some of it on the webinar, and maybe Tom or Jim will correct me if I get this wrong, but in the Georges Bank COD assessment, one of the ways that they corrected the retrospective pattern was to triple the catch. And they could also correct the retrospective pattern by increasing the natural mortality, but they didn't want to do that. So they thought it made more sense, apparently, to triple the catch. So that tells you that they don't really know very much about what the real catch is, if I got that correct. And so, again, this is one way that you can get a lot better information for your stock assessments, which I think everybody would support. I'm not going to speak in length on access to the closed areas. You've all heard me ask you to support that many, many times over the past year, and I'm hopeful that your last very strong vote in favor of that will continue. Thank you.
Patrick.
Thank you, Rip. So a lot of us in the recreational community have been talking about this sector exemption section in Framework 48, and I can't escape saying out loud when I'm in the debate with members of the community, whether they be charter captains or private anglers on shore, that there's just too many fishermen trying to get not enough fish. And that isn't changing. And a fact of that is that when the current management theory went into place, big boats, not doing anything wrong, following the rules, ended up on Stellwagen Bank, fishing where the bulk of the, or ended up inshore where the bulk of the recreational fleet was fishing. And that was a conflict. And then because we're fishing on not enough fish, there were a lot less fish in that area. And the rec fleet moved, what the rec fleet that was big enough and could move, moved farther offshore. We end up fishing now a bunch or a majority of the party charter fleet off of the coast of Massachusetts is fishing in part of this in part of the Western Gulf of Maine closed area that's proposed to be open. As opposed to, some people are claiming that we want our own fishing pond. That's not true. We just want a place to fish that we can fish reliably for some catch. That's what our party charter fleet wants. Our recreational fleet inshore doesn't have that luxury. They're in trouble. People can't go cod fishing. So with that being said, what I would like you to think about as you approach this motion is that we are doing the same thing. And although I may not agree with every detail of everything people are coming up to the mic and saying today, the council right now is looking at doing exactly what the council has always done. And that's not taking a complete holistic move into this new theory. We admit the consolidation has been put off. We admit, and consolidation is part of what may or may not have contributed to what just went on in Stellwagen Bank with us. We admit that we're talking about opening some closed areas that may or may not need to go away, but we're not done with the habitat part of the amendment. Once again, bits and pieces of a move that should be major and that should be completed. But we're not there. This is where we are. We're in Framework 48, right? So instead of having a picture of a management theory that moves forward together, we're going to continue this bits and pieces. And one of the results of what will happen if you open this area in the Western Gulf of Maine closure is that you will have a gear conflict with the recreational for-hire fleet. We're going to be fighting over it. Now it's pollock because we have been fishing in there. And we're going to make this decision based on less data than the decision you just decided to give yourself another month or month and a half to make, because we have less information about what's going on in there than we do with what's going on with some of these stocks. Less information. So I'm going to ask you to remember this now as you go through. It's about to be a really difficult debate. But we're already in trouble from a private angler point of view who can't get to some of these farther offshore areas. And the result of another bits and pieces move is going to be a conflict now with another group of fishermen, arguing with another group of fishermen over not enough fish as a result of a management action that isn't comprehensive. That being said, when you add in the biological concerns, the CAT team gave you information that questioned the economic benefit long-term, because we're all talking about trying to float industries long-term. They told you that the biological benefit was medium to high. I mean, the biological effects were medium to high on some of the most important stocks. So stocks we're already concerned. I haven't heard anybody come up to this microphone and say there's a ton of Gulf of Maine cod. That hasn't happened said once. It's a medium to high stock. We're getting ready to have the end of the end. If we're going to open everything up and it's going to be the wild, wild west and we're going to kill what's left, I don't think so. And I don't think there's a fisherman who wants that. But this bits and pieces stuff, not really thinking the whole picture, what you want the whole picture and the end of it to look like, I don't think we know that yet. So I think that it's premature to open something before you close something. I don't think there's premature to, like, this jigsaw puzzle's got to move together. I don't agree that they should have been split, the closed areas from the habitat areas. I went to Massachusetts public schools. I'm really proud of the schools I went to. Where I come from, reducing overfishing is continuing overfishing are the exact same thing. They're synonymous. And that's what we've been doing for a long time. We all are going to hurt like hell. Every single fleet's about to hurt like hell. Please make it so that we only hurt once. Let's start rebuilding now. Because all opening up these closed areas are going to do, when the best fishermen in the country can't catch record high prices, opening up what little bit is left can do nothing but damage. These areas can't be opened yet. Not because we want our own fishing pond, but because we need to begin rebuilding and we need to implement the rest. If this is the catchier theory is what you guys have gone down, I don't even know if I like it or agree with it, but I know this. I know that the whole thing got to move, but the bits and pieces stuff isn't working. It's clearly not working. And this is just other bits and pieces that don't fit. And this is going to cause you more problems than it's going to solve, biologically, economically, user group against user group. I don't see how that's a game for the council. Thank you.
Back to the council. Terry Stockwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next motion is a combination of sections 4.2.2 and 4.2.2.5. To recommend the council adopt section 4.2.2.2, option 2, the revised goals and objectives, to insert to the extent possible in the first objective after bias, 4.2.2.3, option 3, sub-option B, remove requirement for industry-funded at-sea monitoring and fishing year 2013, and 4.2.2.3, sub-option C1, lower coverage rates for extra-large mesh sink gillnet gear as described, and 4.2.2.4, option 4, industry-funded at-sea monitoring cost responsibility. Additionally, recommend that the Council adopt Section 4.2.2.5.2, Option 2, eliminate days at sea monitoring requirement. This passed the committee 8-1-2.
I think it's dockside monitoring. Okay.
It's been two long days.
Council discussion. Matt McKenzie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to oppose this motion because, frankly, I think monitoring at this point is still an essential way to get good verifiable data at a time when we need all the good verifiable data we can possibly get. We have been talking all morning right now and all afternoon about how the science is problematic and throwing monkey wrenches in all our management processes. Removal of monitoring is only going to make it worse, and so I will not be supporting this motion. Thank you.
Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do support the motion, and I understand that, that monitoring is very important, and I think in the long term we need increased monitoring, but we're just sort of at a crossroads here, and you just cannot get around the fact that, you know, if somebody doesn't have the money to pay for it, they're not going fishing. And I think that, you know, some of these measures in here may be short term, but they are quite necessary, and I will be supporting the motion.
Anyone else on the council? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, this is one of those oh my God situations where you know you got to have a high degree of monitoring. We all know that with the catch share program with hard quarters. We know we need a high degree of monitoring. We're not going to get the high degree of monitoring. We know industry is going to pay for it. No, it can't pay for it because it doesn't have the resources to pay for it. That's very clear. So, all right, we turn to the federal government to provide the necessary coverage, and they can't provide the coverage either because they don't have the funds to cover more than 20% or so, thereabouts. So, unfortunately, we're faced with a motion that I don't like, but then again, there's no other alternative because of a lack of money, because of a lack of resources, and the impossibility of telling the industry, you do it. It's not going to happen. Now, I had yesterday discussed the possibility, I may have even made a motion that was not seconded, I suspect, that if indeed, because we have a fishery disaster, a fishery failure declared by the Secretary of Commerce, no funds yet provided, obviously Congress has not yet taken any action, I had suggested that if indeed Congress does provide funds, and some of the numbers that have been floated have been pretty high, rather high. I suggested that perhaps that money could come and then be reserved in some way, given to the feds, given to the states, given to someone to be used to fund all of the At Sea Observer coverage. So we wouldn't be left with no dockside monitoring and very low At Sea monitoring. But obviously, we don't know what's going to happen with that money if it ever comes, and for what purpose. That's yet to be determined. So I'll be supporting the motion, but very reluctantly, because I, like Matt, believe that we are still on a slippery slope regarding the way we manage this fishery, with there being very little understanding of what is really happening at sea.
Anyone else? I'm going to call the question. Oh, wait, sir. Yeah, I didn't see your hand before.
Yeah, it's kind of difficult to deal with all this bundled together, but we have a number of different comments to make on this. We do support option two to clarify Amendment 16's goal and objectives for sector monitoring. We would like to see the motion modified to include option 3A1 to clarify the CV standard moving forward. That would be to clarify that this would be the CV would be calculated on a stock-wide basis rather than a sector stock basis, correct? We would like to add, to the extent practicable, to the measure text in this section with respect to accuracy, to acknowledge the current limitations on our ability to quantify bias. We have concerns about option 3B being approvable because it doesn't ensure coverage rates will be sufficient to monitor the sector ACEs. And we don't think option 4 is approvable at this time, but we think it has promise in the future when the electronic monitoring can be fully developed, but we would support the reduction in minimum sizes. That was the main ones, I believe.
Anyone on the council? David Pierce.
Yeah, I hate to take another bite, but I've been reminded of an issue that I had forgotten about because they're all bundled, and it's difficult to quickly react to a bundled motion and to recall everything that was said yesterday on this issue. at the beginning of this section on page 66 of the framework, it says very clearly that adequate coverage to combine NEFOP, ASM, and EM is required to meet the need for both precision and accuracy of discard estimates. Well, I'm not so sure we have done anything really meaningful in this framework that deals with the accuracy of the estimates. Precision, yes, but accuracy, I don't think so. I just wanted to make that point that we really, I'm fooling ourselves if we think we have. Perhaps we're going to make the estimates more precise, but they can still be inaccurate and precise or more precise. We do have two sub-options before us, and I do agree with the service that we need to include one of those. So I would make a motion to amend, that amendment being to include sub-option A2. Which is to have the CV standard met for each stock and for each sector, which basically is an individual unit that operates in a way that does require special treatment and a special way in which the CV is calculated to determine the amount of sampling required. So that's my motion to amend.
Is there a second?
Sub-option A2.
Motion fails. Doug Gropp.
I would like to make a motion to amend to approve to include sub-option A1, that the CV standard be met for each stock at the stock level.
So seconded by David Gagel. Discussion on the motion to amend, Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to apologize for the bundled motion, but they are in order on the decision document, and we tried to take that approach yesterday at the committee meeting to try to move the discussion forward. So all the alternatives are listed in order as they appear in your decision document for reference. The reason I chose to leave out the CV standard is that's directly applicable to discards and calculating discards. I personally, and I think I've been upfront about this from the start, I agree with a lot of our speakers that full retention is the way to go, and that means eliminating discard strategy, in my mind, some pretty difficult decisions about how we're going to tweak this or that to get the right CV standard. So I left it out of the motion because I want to support full retention and get away from handcuffing ourselves to discard CV estimates. I think it's forced us into some really weird decisions and made some really weird and I don't think positive decisions about how to allocate limited monitoring resources. That's why I left it out. That's why I'll oppose this. I intend to support full retention.
David Gagel.
I seconded Doug's motion because, and I didn't second David's, even though I'd like to, because I think that's the right way to do it. And if we had the money, that would be the way it would be done. But the fact is we don't have the money, and that would require more observers, more coverage than just doing it to the stock level. As somebody who comes from a small sector, basically two people, probably soon to be zero after today. You know, we have to get it at inordinately high level of coverage. We're up over 50% every year, I think, since this program has started, in order to meet the sector part of this requirement, because we're a small sector. And personally, I didn't put anything up there yesterday because I'm not happy with the CV standards in general. You know, I don't think we should have to meet any CV standard, to be perfectly honest with you. This is all about precision. I'm not terribly interested in precision. I think our whole thing on discards has gotten it precisely wrong. I'm much more interested in accuracy. And we can do better. We can get accuracy with a lot lower level of coverage. And like I said, precision really doesn't matter. Precision is a statistical term that's used for people who want to manipulate the statistics. So at any rate, I'll support the motion to amend.
On the motion to amend, Doug.
Thank you. I appreciate you giving the maker of the motion an opportunity to describe why I supported this motion. And it's basically has to do with the fact that I'm not ready to go to full retention at this particular point. I think I've always been very interested in that concept. I don't think we've developed in a framework a change in policy as big as this that's been fully fleshed out. I think it has a potential for the future if we have the right amount of at-sea monitoring and potentially looking at changes to the mesh size if needed with this. I'm very concerned with full retention about the potential lost long-term yield that's identified in this in our framework 48. So in anticipation that potentially we may not be having a full retention, I feel that we do need to have the CV standard developed. And as Dave said, I think option A2 would have been better, but given the fact that nobody seems to have the money right now for adequate monitoring, I think we've got to look at things that will be cost-effective and at least partially get us that way. And on a final note, I'm one of those crazy people that think that this is that the government, whether it be federal or state, should be responsible for monitoring the catch. It's a public resource. It's our responsibility. I know Magnuson doesn't necessarily agree with that, and neither do a lot of the of my counterparts here, but I do believe that the government, if this is a public resource, we should be monitoring.
Further council discussion? Mary Beth.
Just one quick question. On page 66, under suboption A, the last sentence of the first paragraph, it says the CV standard must be met at the level specified below. And if this motion in its entirety were to pass with the amendment, we would be saying that the industry is not in a position to pay for monitoring, and we know that the agency's ability to cover, you know, a specific percentage is unknown. So I'm just concerned about how that language would move forward. If it says it must be met, well, it's not clear that anyone could meet it, at least in the short term. So does that just mean that it converts to a goal in the short term?
Well, I think I'm going to have to turn to Gene. The idea here is we're trying to establish a standard that we will meet for monitoring. That was what we were trying to do. And I guess that's a good question for the language is what happens if, for whatever reason, there's not enough money to fund it. There is some information in the affected environment section that talks about what that coverage level would be. I'm trying to find the page number now. Take me a minute to find it. While Gene's answering, I'll look it up.
No, Tom's basically correct. We're currently required under the Amendment 16 implementing regs to determine what level is necessary based on a CV equal to the SBRM CV and at a level to accurately monitor sector operations what sectors have to pay for. And then they are required, the sectors are required to provide us a plan how they're going to meet that level of coverage in order to have an approvable sector operations plan. And if you recall, we are being sued currently by Oceana on our approval of the 2012 sector operations plan, primarily on grounds that our determination for the level that we determined was necessary for the 2012 sector operations plan was not adequately justified or explained by the agency in approving the sector operations plan. plans.
Further council discussion? Mary Beth.
So I'm sorry, I got a little distracted there through part of what Gene just said, but it does seem problematic to have in here something that says, you know, the language is very clear that it must be met. And then other parts of the motion are acknowledging that that it's unclear where the funds would come from to do that. So I'm just, I guess a question for Gene, looking at the parts and pieces here, do we need to somehow put, you know, a caveat in here that it would start in 2014 or when the funds are available? Or I'm not sure exactly the right wording, but just a question.
You want to answer that, Gene? Or?
I don't want to, but I guess I have to. I mean, several of these motions are inconsistent with what you're doing. You're adopting goals and objectives for monitoring sector operations plan, and then at the same time you're adopting or considering adopting a plan to or a measure that will take away, at least for 2013, the requirement for sector operations plan to pay for that monitoring. And if the agency doesn't have enough money on its own to voluntarily pay for that plan, then that's a disconnect with that objective. So, you know, it's hard for me to tell you how to get out of that hole. I think you have to take into account all of these factors in deciding how you're voting here. I guess you could make exceptions. I'm not advocating this because we've already gone on record fairly strongly that we don't agree with the part of the motion that would take away the sector responsibility to fund the necessary at-sea monitoring level. But if you want to try to make it consistent, I think you would want language that makes it clear as to which years you're exempting sectors from in terms of their requirements to provide at-sea monitoring and so forth.
Mary Beth.
Given that, I guess I would ask, in just the process, we're still on the not voted on the amendment, correct?
We're still.
Okay. So the maker of the motion, Doug, in light of that discussion, the staff has some language up there that might get us out of that. Did you have a chance to read it? It's on the board.
Mayor Depp, I'm happy with the way that motion was put up. I understand the concerns here. If you have concerns about it and want to modify it, you're certainly welcome to amend it. But I'm happy with the way that motion is stated right now.
I'm just concerned that if we weren't to try to change this particular language, then it just leaves the agency in the same position, sounds like they're perhaps currently in, and that, you know, they could easily be sued on that particular thing. It's a standard, and I don't disagree with the standard. I think the standard is fine, but if the reality is in the short term it's not possible to implement it, it just seems like there should be some ability to modify that. So if you could put that language back up that you had, I would make a motion to amend the amendment that would add at the very end that the funding for this CV would start in 2014 or when funds are available.
I think the proper thing would be a motion to substitute essentially the same motion with that language in it.
Whatever you think is the best, Mr. Chairman.
So it would include all of the previous language and that addition to it. Is there a second to that? Motion fails. We're back on the motion to amend. Further discussion. Dave Gaethel.
I think Doug made a very important point here about this being a function of government. And that's one of the reasons I seconded the motion, because I knew he was going to do that. And I think this council should send a clear message that this is a function of government. Government is vast. It has vast resources. It can shift some of those resources around. And, that's what should be done. If there's a certain CV standard that has to be met and it requires a certain amount of funding and the funding's only available, then, maybe somebody else will have to lose their job so we can have the funding that's necessary, whatever it takes. But I think it's a function of government, and that's what this says. I mean, it says that you will do it. It doesn't say if the money's available or you'll do it in 2014 or sometime in the future when more money's available. It says you'll do it. And if that's unapprovable, then don't approve it. That's fine with me. But I think the message has to be sent.
I'm going to move this along. I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion to amend? No, we're on the motion to amend. Back. All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 in favor. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 opposed. Abstention? Recuse? No recuse. Okay. The motion to amend carries. We're on the main motion is amended. Further discussion? Call the question. All those in favor? 11. Opposed? 4 opposed. Abstention? Recusal? No. Okay, so the motion carries 11 to 4. Terry.
Section 4.2.3, recommend the council adopt section 4.2.3.3, full retention, carried in the committee 5-3-2.
Committee motion, no second required, discussion. Dave Gaethel.
Well, the first thing I'm going to need before I could even possibly support this is a statement from every state director here that they will eliminate state minimum fish sizes, because otherwise we're in a perfect quandary, as fishermen always are, that, we'll be illegal if we throw it overboard, and if we bring it in, we'll be arrested by the state. So absent that statement, I can't even begin to think about supporting full retention. So I'll wait to hear from every state director.
Tom Dempsey.
Well, I just wanted to speak for the state of Massachusetts. Before I do that. In all seriousness, I think you could say that about, or that barrier applies whether you're talking about full retention or just changing these size limits. I think Dr. Pierce spoke to that yesterday. To me, just changing the minimum size limits, which is the other alternative apart from status quo in the document, has all the risks, all the barriers, and none of the upside. And I think we've heard quite a bit from the audience today about the upside and the long-term potential of a full retention transition. Part of that is getting away from assumed discard rates. We heard a lot about that from fishermen who are struggling to lease fish to cover fish that they're not catching. That needs to stop. That doesn't make any sense. Talk about the problems funding monitoring and the need to have monitoring and accountability at a level sufficient for our management. And we're just going to continue to bash our heads up against that wall as long as we're relying on human observers that are costly and present all sorts of challenges, logistical and otherwise. I think when John Bullard came out to chat and we talked about what the challenges are in front of the service, we talked about the expanding obligations from a data standpoint, from real-time information about the fishery, and how we're going to meet all those standards with a smaller and smaller budget. And the industry can't afford to help. And I think the only way to do that is to make a structural change in the fishery that allows us to use some of the tools that people like Frank Morarchy and others were talking about. And I think that's what full retention allows us to do. It has many of the same risks and requires monitoring, requires some, you know, logistical follow-up. We need to figure out some of these details prior to implementation, but I think that can be done. I think the service, along with the rest of us, should be supporting a structural change that allows us to get past some of the walls that we've been banging our heads against for a while. So for all those reasons, I support full retention. Without the benefit of the full retention and changing this fishery, I can't see just changing the minimum fish sizes. I really don't. I think it has all the downside and none of the upside.
David Pierce.
Well, there are some very compelling reasons to go with the full retention. You know, Tom just went through a short list, and certainly those who came to the microphone provided their perspectives, which were, I think, almost unanimously in favor of the full retention option. And why not? Because if you have full retention as a specific regulation, that means there's no discarding. And if there's no discarding of groundfish, then there's no deduction off of the aces of discard. So the aces basically increase. Fishermen get more fish, right? Because you're not going to be penalized for discards, real or imagined. Imagine in the case of David Gethel's situation where, as he has repeatedly said, he gets discards deducted from him even when he's not fishing. It's the way in which we calculate discards applied to an entire sector. So if a sector vessel is not fishing, it still gets penalized for discard. So it's a foolish situation, to say the least. All right, so I can see the merits of it. But there's an expectation that the states will remove all of their minimum sizes for groundfish, and I don't believe we will, because there has yet to be a convincing argument for us to remove all of the minimum sizes for our groundfish that have been adopted over the years in the interest of conservation and in the interest of persuading fishermen to avoid small fish and not land small fish. So, and besides, full retention. Come on, let's face it. Let's be realistic here. With the observer coverage that we have, if a fisherman does not want to bring in a fish for whatever reason, he's going to throw it over the side. No one's watching. Full retention. The discarding will still occur if indeed something is being caught that the fishermen do not want to bring ashore. If the dealers, for example, won't buy those fish, won't take those fish, especially if the fish that are coming ashore because they have to fully retain them happen to be too small fish. All right. What do the dealers do with that fish when they come ashore, assuming the minimum sizes have been completely done away with by the states? Do all the fish go into bait? I suppose that's a good use in the eyes of some people, not in my eyes. There needs to be incentive for fishermen to stay off of the smaller fish. And I appreciate the fact that the mesh selectivity is such that when you're out there fishing with regulated mesh, large mesh, because mesh selectivity is so flat, you're going to catch smaller fish below the minimum size, below the legal size. That happens, and it will always happen. We do not have sharp-edge selectivity in the nets we use in the groundfish fishery, even though we've tried time and time again. So the full retention, the discarding will still occur. And why do I think that? Well, I've been around since 1977, 78, doing groundfish in one way or another. And back during the early days, the council had a no-discard rule. We had that for a few years, I think, and that failed miserably because quickly we realized it wasn't working. Fishermen were still discarding at sea. And why not? They had no choice. In that particular case, there were possession limits, and there were other complicating factors. All right, so now, the document itself says that the purpose of this full retention is not to have fishermen or promote the targeting of smaller fish. Well, sure, and fishermen don't want to target fish. Why would they? Less price per pound, Many are conservation-minded. They would rather go after the larger fish, stay away from the smaller fish, but they're not going to be able to avoid the smaller fish. And why is that? Because of the dilemma we have with our ground fish fishing industry, with the resource, where, for the most part, the stocks are relatively low. And we are, and we have always been, in the ground fish fishery, dependent upon incoming recruit. We always wait with bated breath for the next good year class. Here it comes. Where is it? We hope it's there. It'll support the fishery for years to come. And fishermen, of course, lie in wait for that year class to become catchable. Why not? They need to live. They need a livelihood. They need to make some income. So if there's nothing else there but an incoming year class, they wait with bated breath for it to be legal size. So if the market will exist or does exist in the future for smaller size fish, and I suspect it will for many of the stocks, as a year class recruits, as it grows, it will be targeted as smaller fish. And the document itself indicates on page 484 the consequences of targeting smaller fish. And I'm not saying fishermen would target them because they want to. They would target them because they'll be the only ones on the grounds, and the market will be there for them for the most part. On page 484, in a summary statement, it says, there are several possible biological impacts of requiring sectors to retain all allocated regulated ground fish. These impacts depend on whether this measure leads to a shift in selectivity in the fishery and results in catching a greater proportion of small fish. And I think it will happen. I'm confident it will happen. Then it says, if such a change occurs, the yield per recruit would be expected to decline. This would lead to a reduction in FMSY or its proxy. It would also lead to an increase in biomass targets. So we worsen the situation for ourselves. I'm trying to think ahead. I'm trying to anticipate what will likely happen, and I suspect that's what will happen. And then when assessments are done, when data are reviewed by the assessment scientists, who, by the way, do a damn good job with the data that's available to them and the models they have to use, and we'll find ourselves faced with lower F targets and with higher biomass targets because the fishery has shifted to smaller fish because it can due to... For all the reasons I have so specified. I see the merits of it. This is not an easy decision for me, but I and others in my same situation, other state directors, for example, and the commissions with which we work and the councils with which we work are very unlikely to support doing away with all the minimum size regulations. All of them, gone. It's just unreasonable.
Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is a response by the Secretary that's in the Magnuson Act to states that don't comply with federal plans. And I'll read it into the record. Any state that has taken any action or omitted to take any action, the results of which will substantially and adversely affect the carrying out of a fishery management plan, the Secretary shall promptly notify such state and the appropriate council of the finding and of his intention to regulate the applicable fishery within the boundaries of such state. And it goes on further. There can be a hearing if the state requires a hearing before the Secretary. But there is a section in Magnuson that talks about consistent state plans with federal plans so you won't be prosecuted for obeying a federal plan.
Gene?
Actually, I was going to make the same point. I think, you know, the states need to be committed, if this is passed and approved, the states need to be committed to follow suit, or we're going to have real problems. If states don't follow suit, we'll either have to, you know, go with the section that Paul just read, and in the meantime, it means that vessels could not land their fish in those states that haven't followed suit yet. There would have to be an expectation that the states would have put into place consistent regs, and there may even be a need to have some sort of transition period to allow that to happen, unless the states, I mean, they can get things in a lot quicker than we can usually, so that may or may not be a problem. But it's a very realistic concern that would need to be handled straightforwardly.
Matt McKenzie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with the goals of full retention. I think it should be something we work towards. I just don't think this is ready for prime time on a variety of levels. I would love to see this come back before this council when there's more structural support behind it, but right now I can't support this measure. Thank you.
Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Notwithstanding the arguments regarding the efficacy of the concept, I wanted to speak a little bit about this issue of monitoring and potential use of electronic monitoring, because that's come up several times during today's discussions. And last month, there was a meeting of the agency's leadership council where the issues relating to electronic monitoring and where the agency is actually going to be coming from came up. And this is part of an ongoing discussion with regards to policy. And there's still some unresolved issues, but in seeking some guidance with regards to where we might go pending resolution of those issues, there was, I believe, and John might want to speak to this as well, a consensus that at least in concept, using EM to monitor for compliance with a full retention requirement made sense and would be supported. And we have begun some discussions between the center and the region with regards to how we might develop that capacity and how we might move forward with that. Of course, it's not ready for prime time for 2013, but it is something that is under discussion and that we will be keeping the council informed of as the thinking develops. Thank you.
Peter Kendall.
I just wondered if, Terry, could you refresh my memory from yesterday? Was this just sectors or was this common pool as well?
Tom? The full retention is just for sectors because the common pool is still managed with trip limits.
Doug Grout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I mentioned previously, I have always been intrigued by this concept of full retention, and I think it's something that the council should explore in the future in depth. But I don't think at the point right now where we're in a crisis mode that this is the right time to move forward with it without a full examination of what's going to be needed to effectively implement this. So as a result, I'm going to make a motion to amend to replace option 3 with option 2, and obviously that means getting rid of the full retention wording at the end.
You're seconding? Seconded by Dave Gaethel. Substitute. Mark Gibson, I had you on next on the list. Did you still want to speak?
No, it's not clear to me what the motion to amend is at this point, so I'll pass for now.
Terry Alexander.
I was actually going to do the same thing Doug did because I didn't see it going anywhere. I actually voted for the full retention yesterday, and I did, knowing full well that we're probably going to have this discussion again today, but... the council has already voted to talk about full retention in the next amendment. Is that right, Rip?
Must be late in the day. I'm having trouble recalling that.
In a previous action, you had voted to talk about full retention and priorities? No. Okay. Then... would it be appropriate to amend this motion to say that we will talk about those in the next action, full retention in the next action, to appease some of the people that are full retention fans?
Yes, you can do that. You should do that. Ask them
to put the phone. This is one saying the wording there should be it's a motion to substitute.
Maybe a friendly amendment.
with the motion to substitute, I guess I would see if it could be done as a friendly, and if not, you'll have to make that.
Personally, I'd rather have that as a separate motion. I don't know. I would say it would be the next appropriate management action if I were to make that motion in the future. But I'd rather have this be cleaner personally.
Terry?
That's fine with me. I'll make the motion after this motion gets passed. Thank you.
David Pierce.
I think, as the council knows, the states continue to try to be good partners with the federal government, with all council members. We are a council member. We always try to do that. We have demonstrated that consistently, support of council initiatives, decisions that we are involved in making. So I got to love you, Paul, whenever you bring out the state preemption card, be it on dogfish or now be it on groundfish. Got to love you. I'm thinking about a retirement gift for you. It's going to have to somehow be related to this. And then Gene, of course, puts another arrow in the quiver. And listen, I would say give it your best shot. But how are you going to hit the target, be accurate, when you don't have any monitoring that's of a sufficient level to prevent discarding? I mean, come on, full retention with low levels of coverage. They're going to discard because they have no choice. Anyways, it'll make for interesting discussion if this particular amendment, the substitute, is not passed and we end up going with full retention. All right. Let's see. So we would go with, and also, of course, the common pool, different minimum size from potentially from sector vessels. How does that work? It gets very strange, to say the least. Recreational fishermen with one minimum size, they have minimum sizes, and commercial fishermen do not. Interesting. That's also another problem. We've dealt with that in our state time and time again for all sorts of stocks. How do you say to the recreational fishermen, oh, by the way, you have minimum sizes up here, and commercial fishermen who catch thousands of pounds on the same grounds as you, they have no minimum size. And, oh, by the way, well, anyways. All right, so the move to substitute still gets me to the same problem of not quite the same problem. It's not as great a problem, but it does involve reducing minimum sizes for some of the key stocks. On haddock, I've always supported going to a lower minimum size because haddock has been growing slower, and we've needed to reduce the minimum size to provide fishermen with an opportunity to catch those fish. But the other stocks, the other species, don't grow that slowly. Cod, for example, doesn't take long for a cod to grow from 19 inches to 22 inches, 22 being the current size, dropping it down to 19. I don't think I will support either the motion to substitute or the main motion.
Anyone else? Dave Gaisel.
I do support this motion. I think this will get rid of the vast majority of regulatory discards and still keeps us away from my enforcement concerns with full retention. This is the, you know, by and large, this is the size of the minimum size of the fish that's retained by GEAR now. So there's not incentive to cheat. Full retention to me made me incredibly uncomfortable because, as David has rightly said, if there's an incoming year class, large numbers, and it's close to shore, and it's worth a buck a pound, or you can go a long ways and it's worth a dollar and a quarter, why not? Laura's not here, so she's the only dealer present, but I believe all of this is saleable at this size, other than perhaps redfish. I realize this is a difficult decision. It's a difficult decision for me. I supported minimum sizes that are compatible with the minimum mesh size. I personally use a mesh size larger than the minimum required mesh size because I'm attempting to do two things. You know, one is not catch small fish, and the second is maximize what little quota I have. So I'm kind of thinking, I mean, you know, it is a difficult decision, and I'm certainly sympathetic to the argument that people don't want to go backwards. But I do think, I mean, if you go and look at the tables that were that Fiona produced, this still keeps us above the level where the fish are spawning. So I guess all things being said, this is probably about as good as we can do at this time, so I'll support the motion.
Frank Baum.
Yes, thank you. I'm just struggling with the justification of why this would only be for sector boats and not for common pool. I understand that. Is it in there? Okay.
I'll take it back.
Full retain. Okay, sorry.
Anyone else? Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick points. I'd prefer the full retention. I've always been in favor of full retention, but the logistics simply aren't going to work out at this point. As we have seen, the states can't go along with it, and the monitoring isn't in place. The option two was, I was still on the ground fish committee when this was proposed, and the idea was to bring it to a point where most, and as David just pointed out a few minutes ago, given the current mesh size that this would be appropriate for most of these species. This represents the smallest that are normally picked up by these by the net, and also it does get us to a length at 50% maturity. It's an in between thing. It's an improvement over no action. It doesn't get us as far as full retention, which I think we do need to move toward, but it is a move in the right direction. So I will support it. Thank you.
I'm going to Mark Gibson, and then
Chairman,
I'm going to call a question.
I can support this as a reasonable compromise. I couldn't have supported full retention for all the arguments that Dave Pierce expounded on. But this option, too, it eliminates my winter flounder problem because that doesn't change discrepancies between recreational and commercial sizes. We'll have to think about that when we get home, but I think at least at the council level I can support this. Thank you.
I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion to substitute. 12 in favor. Opposed. 4 opposed. Abstention. None. The motion carries. Now we're on the main motion. A substitute. Further discussion. Call the question. All those in favor. 12 in favor. Opposed. 4 opposed. Abstention. Motion carries. 12-4. Terry.
Section 4.2.4. Recommend the council adopt section 4.2.4.2, option 2, Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder revised discard strata applicable to sector trips only. Pass the committee 7-0-2.
Committee motion, no second. Discussion. I'm going to call the question. All those in favor? 15 opposed. Abstention. Motion carries 15-0-0. Terry.
Section 4.2.5. Recommend the council adopt section 4.2.5.2, option 2, exemption from year-round mortality closures. Pass the committee 5-2-2.
Committee motion, no second. Discussion. I'm going to go with Matt and then David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been thinking long and hard about this, and the testimony today only confirmed a lot of my concerns about the state of the fishery right now, the need for positive action to preserve fishing communities, the fishing industry, but also stocks of fish. I have a problem with this option as it is currently written, because it lumps, currently we don't know, as it's written, it is not clear which areas are open and which areas can be accessed, which areas are not, do not qualify for application to access. And as a result of that, I'd like to put forward a motion to another. I'll have a motion in the future, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. But as this is written, I'm not in favor of it right now.
David Pierce.
Yeah, we discussed this, of course, at length yesterday, and we did benefit from a very well-done analysis by the Close Area Tactical Team, the so-called CAT. Andy Applegate did a great job providing the conclusions of the CAT, the results of their analysis. And I must say it was helpful, although he did say from the get-go that his crew, the CAT, was handicapped because it didn't have all the data it really needed and all the data that this council would have wanted to analyze. For example, we're relying heavily on spring and fall bottom troll survey information regarding biomass distribution in the areas, outside the areas. We don't have summer or winter data that would help us better understand the benefits to the industry of being allowed. It's awful noisy in here, Mr. Chairman. Could you, it's distracting.
Can we take conversations outside, please, if you need to have them?
So we don't have that important information to help us better understand the merits, the benefits to the industry of getting that summertime and that wintertime access. And I was very disappointed in that. I thought that there would be some other data sources they could use to help us in that regard, but it wasn't there. When we go over the information provided by the CAT, when I went over it, I didn't see much benefit, if any benefit, to the industry getting access into the Georges Bank, into the Georges Bank closed areas. It didn't seem, it was not, there was no clear benefit from the analysis that was done. And I say that also reminding the council that even though the title of this section is exemption from year-round mortality closures, let's not forget it's not a year-round possible exemption. We're only talking about providing access from May 1 through February 15. Okay, so that's why I say not having winter, not having summer and winter information is a bit troubling and unfortunate. All right. So, anyways, with those data shortfalls, we still have to act on this, and we have gotten some very good comment from the industry relative to their strongly desiring access. I did make a motion yesterday for a change to the motion, and I'm going to make it again. My colleague to my right here lost his opportunity to make his motion, so I'm going to make one. But you can, of course, you know, carry on after that. We have received many, many emails from fishermen, recreational fishermen in particular, who have been fishing in the closed area, certainly in the eastern portion of the western Gulf of Maine closed area, and they have made it very clear time and time again in telephone calls, correspondence of all sorts, emails, letters, that they're finding it incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to fish in those areas because of they would not be able to fish in those areas the way they have if access is allowed to the commercial fishery, because they would be in there taking advantage of whatever abundance of fish is there, and God bless them, why shouldn't they? But it would lead to real conflicts between those user groups. As a consequence of that, I've been convinced that it makes sense for us to not allow access to all the closed areas. Therefore, I would move to amend that the Western Gulf of Maine closed area would not be one of the candidate areas for exemption from year-round mortality closures. The others would, but not the Western Gulf of Maine closure.
Is there a second to the motion? Matt? Discussion? Matt, did you have a comment?
I'd like to move to amend the amendment.
Can
I do that? No, not yet.
Now.
I'd like to eventually.
Frank Blount.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm not, this is going to the main motion or this motion. On page 27 of the presentation yesterday, when you look at the impacts, and this goes back to it, I'm going to go to Georges Bank Cod, Gulf of Maine Cod. When it comes to spawning, it's medium to high. For spawning potentials, medium to high. Prevention of subpopulations, medium and high. Rebuilding potential impacts, medium and high. And those are two of the stocks that we're very concerned about. And in the presentation yesterday, those are the ones that we have the most concern with. Well, I take that back. Georges Bank, Southern New England, Winter Flounder. We're high all the way across the board except for medium for Georges Bank and high for Southern New England. Based on that, I don't see the justification on opening these areas. The potential is very high for impacts on these three stocks. And those, granted, for Pollock, you know, it looks like the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do for probably Redfish. It looks like the right thing. You know, Mugfish, Winterskate, Thornyskate looks good. But the stocks of concern that we're here today with the most trouble on, the impacts are medium to high. And based on that, I can't support it. Opening them all. Thank you.
Further discussion? Terry Alexander.
I'm dead set against Dave's motion. I am for the original motion, but I'm against Dave's motion because we've done nothing for the boats in the Gulf of Maine to mitigate the cuts that they have coming. And there is no reason. We fished those areas for years and years and years. There's no reason, logically, looking at this cat, all the work the cat has done, not to open them. Frank's talking about the high thing, but we're going to be using separated gear under the sector rules to mitigate the cod and yellowtail bycatch out there. So, I mean, and the cat is using the information that that we're going to be fishing with normal commercial fishing gear out there, and it's wrong for us to tell people in southern New England and the bigger boats to that they may be able to go to Cassius when the 40-foot boats or 50-foot boats that want to fish the western edge of the eastern edge of the closed area, western Gulf of Maine closed area, will have no access to anything to mitigate their cuts. Redfish, pollock, monkfish all along that edge a lot. Access to them are going to be brought down by their graceful allocation. So it's not like we're going to be going in there free reign. You're going to have a high tack, a constraining stock that's going to stop you from fishing in there. And there's a million different reasons why we need that area open.
Doug Grout.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the one of two issues in a Framework 48 that I've really struggled with the most, particularly the amendment that Dr. Pierce has put forward to us, because I am struggling with whether to open up that eastern edge of Georges Bank. I mean, excuse me, the Western Gulf of Maine closure. And what I probably shouldn't be second-guessing here, but I really wish I'd been down here for the Groundfish Committee, because I didn't realize that this presentation that Andy had given was not going to be given today. I was kind of hoping there'd be something on his work here. So I've had to go through I've gone through the document, and I see a lot of conflicting pieces of information on whether this is going to be beneficial and what the effect is going to be on the abundance. Because I see on one hand, on page 514, it said the highest abundance of large female cod were in the habitat closed area of the Western Gulf of Maine and not the proposed sector exemption. But then there's another, it also goes on to say that the trawl survey CPUE was higher in the surrounding areas within the Western Gulf of Maine habitat area. I assume, Andy, that means within that sliver that we're the area that we're proposing to open. But as I said, there's many things in here that have, to me, are conflicting. The other things, just before you get to your answer, I also see that there does not appear to be a clear consensus of the effectiveness of the Western Gulf of Maine closure for cod. And it goes on and on. So I'm not sure whether there's going to be a benefit to keeping this closed.
Yeah, to your immediate question about the area outside of the closed area, 10-mile buffer, that's what that was related to. And that's an area that had been more intensively fished than other areas. Some of that relates to fish exiting the area and become available to fishing, and that's where fishing is sometimes more profitable. With respect to cod and the HAPC, that was certainly true, but in terms of the table labeled qualitative impacts, the CAT members were took in a broader scale of issues, including things like seasonal availability of the fish. For example, cod were often found in the EFH areas, but we realized that during other seasons they might shift a little bit in the deeper water on the eastern Gulf of Maine and transit through the area and become available to the fishery. Another type of consideration was the stock status and that removal of large females might have relative to rebuilding. And so that may relieve your concern about some conflicting information in the document. There were different levels of consideration made by the CAT. The overall analysis is folded into this table of qualitative impacts, biological impacts.
Terry Alexander.
I left out something in my haste. The CAT is analyzing only using the trawl survey. The trawl survey is in there once in the spring, once in the fall, for a week, 2-3 days he might spend on the edge there or wherever, with the other 50 weeks out of the year. So I don't think it's a fair – it's the best he could do with the information that they had, but I don't think it's a fair snapshot to look at this and say, well, obviously they're not going to catch any more pollock out there because there aren't any. They're going to do better on monks or whatever. I just don't think that's a fair representation of what is there. The boats fish there for a lot of years, and you have BTI data to prove where we work that edge and stuff. So,
Dave Gaisman.
Yeah, I have a question for the maker and seconder of the motion. Is your intent... I can't tell from this. Is your intent to prevent all fishing in this area?
No, it's specific to the commercial fishery, acknowledging that the recreational fishery is in there. And that was our intent all along. It still is. No changes have been made.
The reason I asked is I hope everybody sees the logical inconsistency in a number of the arguments that are being made here. On the one hand, people are arguing, we got to close this because – we got to protect the fish, you know, high, high, medium, high, low, high, roast me on high, whatever. But the fact is that on the one hand, they're making an argument that we got to protect the fish. And then in the next statement, and then in the next statement is, but we're going to let the people that catch 38% of those fish in there to fish. That's an inconsistent argument. If your argument is you want to protect the fish, that I can support. Close it. Close it to everybody. Nobody fishes there. No commercial, no recreational, nobody. That's a logical argument. If the argument is for habitat, that's an argument to take up at the Habitat Committee. But I can't support something that to me is a violation of National Standard 4. You know how I feel about National Standard 4. The courts obviously don't agree with me, but fairness and equity, to me, means you treat everybody the same across the board. And I've said it from day one about closed areas. If you believe closed areas really have an effect, then close it to everybody. Nobody fishes there. If you don't think closed areas have an effect, then open it to everybody. But don't start picking winners and losers. We've done far too much of that in this council in the 9 years I've been here. And so, like I said, if you want to amend the motion to say it's closed for fish stock improvement and nobody fishes there, I'll support the motion. Other than that, I'm going to oppose it.
Peter Kendall.
Yes, thank you. I can't support the motion to amend, and I'm comfortable with the main motion. I really don't see, with these levels that we could be faced with. I wish we had gotten into them today, but we'll find out in January. If we have some cuts, you're not going to see many boats going there. They're not going to see the heavy impact that everybody thinks is going to be in that area. Thank you.
Mary Beth, and I'm going to call the question.
I agree with Peter's comments.
I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion to amend. Three in favor. Four. Excuse me. Opposed. Twelve. Abstention. Motion fails. We're on the main motion. I realize that. I'm trying to see where. Why did I think there was a second? Matt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make a motion to amend. Juanita, you have the language? I can read into the record. The motion reads to limit the closed area accessible through section 4.2.5.2 option 2 to closed area 2 south of the southernmost boundary of the HAPC area and to the Nantucket Lightship closed area. Those would be the only two areas available for sectors to apply for access. And if I can get a second, I'll provide rationale.
Seconded by David Pierce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The CAT committee, the CAT team's report yesterday has been consistent. It is working with limited data, but that is the best available science that we have. The upside for this is limited. The downside is pronounced. And frankly, the potential impacts, the long-term impacts for industry are some things that concern me greatly. I feel that more people are going to go out of business in 3 years with access to all the closed areas than we'll save next year by allowing access to all closed areas. That said, Mr. Chairman, we do need to give something to industry to help them through these tough times. Even the extension of the ACL discussion notwithstanding, the areas I proposed here have been scalloped, so the habitat recovery is limited, and we do have very high concentrations of haddock. Granted, there's also high concentrations of yellowtail, which the industry will be challenged to avoid. But I think this is the right thing to do. It gives people a little more access to areas that have been accessed by other sectors in this fishery, and I think it'll also continue to protect the areas that are of most particular concern. Thank you.
Anyone want to speak in support of the motion? Mark Alexander.
Yeah, I've gone back and forth on this, but I think this is a reasonable compromise. I think it keeps some areas closed to preserve whatever protection they've provided in the past, but it also gives them access to help support the fishery.
Against? Mary Beth?
I don't think it's a reasonable compromise, and I certainly would not support it. I think that, the distributional effects for a small boat in the Gulf of Maine are quite significant with this. I mean, it does nothing for them, absolutely zero. I don't support the motion.
Anyone in support? Okay, I'm going to call a question. All those in favor of the motion to amend? 4. Opposed? 12. 12 opposed. Abstention? 1. Motion fails. We're back on the main motion. I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 13 in favor. Opposed? 3 opposed. Abstention? None. The motion carries. Terry.
This is the last committee motion on Framework 48. It's combined sections 4.6 and 4.2.6.5. It's to recommend that the council adopt section 4.2.6.2, option 2, change to AM timing for stocks not allocated to sectors. Sections 4.2.6.3, option 3, area-based accountability measures for Atlantic halibut, Atlantic wolffish, and southern New England mid-Atlantic winter flounder. Section 4.2.6.4, option 4, modifications to the accountability measures for southern New England mid-Atlantic windowplane flounder. And section 4.2.6.5, option 5, the revised HA and HB permit accountability measures. And section 4.2.7.2, option 2, removal of the trawl gear storage requirements. Passed the committee 7-0-2.
Committee motion. No second required. Discussion. Tom Dempsey.
Thanks, Rip. Like today, yesterday, we were struggling to wrap up after a really full agenda. So that's the reason for the combined motion. We tried to deal with a couple of these issues. So one of the issues that we discussed at length yesterday was the need for accountability measures, approvable accountability measures for halibut and wolffish. Those are non-allocated groundfish stocks. We went through the process in the last framework trying to create accountability measures that work. We didn't get there. We punted to this framework, and because of everything else on our plates, we simply haven't worked to create viable accountability measures, and we're stuck with overlaying area-based management and effort controls on an output-based and catch share fishery. So I understand the need to check that box and put an accountability measure in this framework. If we vote this up, I'll be prepared to bring a motion that we revise and perfect particularly the wolffish and halibut accountability measures in the next available groundfish action. So those are my comments.
Further discussion? I'm going to call the question. All those in favor of the motion? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 16, unanimous. Tom Dempsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hopefully we can deal with this very quickly. Anyone familiar with the accountability measures that are currently in the document and we will be sending to NIMS, particularly for wolffish, recognizes that it lacks accountability. It's an accountability measure in name only. That common pool catch in the mobile gear fleet in Stellwagen can shut down an area on George's Bank, north of the channel, for almost the entire fishing year for gill nets and long lines. I mean, so the people who are paying that back aren't the people who interacted with that fish in the first place. I think it's something that we've moved away from and moved away from with good reason. So I'd move that the council revise and reconsider the Atlantic halibut and Atlantic wolffish accountability measures in the next available groundfish action, or next appropriate groundfish action.
Is there a second to that motion? Seconded by Matt McKenzie. Discussion? Call the question. All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, Oh, 16, I didn't see. It's unanimous.
Yep.
Terry.
Tom, needs a clarification on CV standards.
But actually, I have 2 points. One relates to the last motion. It was something we talked about the committee meeting yesterday, and that's the Southern New England winter flounder AM area. The committee agreed with using figure 8 in the document on page 88 rather than figure 7. Just wanted to make that clear. With respect to the AM, the CV standard, we noticed, and I apologize for this, that it says allocated stocks is for the CV standard. And we've been struggling for about the last 2 hours to figure out why it just says allocated stocks, and I frankly don't know why. I can't trace it back. But the way it's worded right now, it says allocated stocks, which means you wouldn't have any standard on things like windowpane flounder, ocean pout, Atlantic halibut, or wolffish. I just want to bring that to the council's attention. And I cannot really offer a rationale for why it just says allocated. We traced it back. It originated coming out of the PDT, but a couple of us have tried to talk about it here in the background, and frankly, we can't remember why we wrote it to say just allocated. So I need to bring that up. I don't know if Gene needs to comment on that for the council or how difficult it would be to change it.
Yeah, I mean, I think if the council would recognize, given the uncertainty about this, if there's no reason for that and for consistency purposes to make this measure effective, if we could just run it down ourselves, and if we find that unallocated stocks weren't meant to be excluded from the CV standard, that we'll just put it into the regulatory text the way it should have been, and you can deem it at that time. Or we could bring it up again, I guess, at the – well, I don't know. I think it's problematic to bring it up at the next meeting because we're not dealing with any other issues here.
Is there any objection to doing it the way that Gene suggested? You. Okay. You got the okay. – you all set, Tom, on that? Okay. Terry.
One issue at about the same time of the day the committee discussed yesterday was a concern about the agency potentially selecting measures that were rejected by either the committee or the council. So I'm not sure of the appropriate language we need or whether it's verbally express that we were, you know, the committee was concerned about the RA not considering rejected measures as part of the final package. Tom, can you help me out with that? Because my brain's deader than yours is right now.
Technology.
Okay. Thank you, sir. I have a motion. And my motion is that the council specifically rejects the framework 48 alternatives that were not selected.
Is there a second to that motion? Tom Dempsey. Discussion. Dave Gaethel.
Well, I support the idea, but isn't this premature? I mean, we're not submitting this. Since we punted on the only important part of it, the specifications,
Now, the intention is to submit this as a separate document, and the specifications will be separate.
All right, well, I'll support the motion.
Any further discussion on that? Gene?
Well, from the motion, I don't see it. It sounds like all... This only applies to specifications, this option. I mean, this provision about selecting specification options that were not rejected, not all measures.
I mean, I defer to Gene, but, I mean, I thought the regulatory text was kind of vague about what it did and did not apply to. I actually thought the opposite, that it applied to the measures and not specs. But maybe Gene can check the regs. Maybe this isn't needed at this point.
Gene, your comment was it was just in the case of the specifications.
Right. That's my view. I'm just to take.
If you want to withdraw it.
Once we get the clarification, if it's specific to the specifications, I'll withdraw the motion.